today, Dr. Chinguina is internationally renowned, and he has agreed. You see, what happened was I went and suffered and went to Hawaii because he invited me to the International Stroke Conference. So he has now gladly agreed to come to the school and speak with you as the trade-off. So I think I got the better deal, but we're very honored to have you today. And he's going to give you the first introduction about stroke. What is it? What are stroke units? How do you get optimal care early on? And then I'll continue with the second half of the lecture. Your lecture's large. Don't worry, because I have the screw on and on, so we can adjust our time.
Should I have a laser pointer?
Welcome.
Thank you.
Just use your
mouse
and
okay.
Whip it around with the trick, hopefully. And if not, I can get you laser. I'm off to do that.
All right. So it's a pleasure to be here. Nicole didn't really tell me who I was talking to, so I had no idea what to expect. And then she also said there'd be a few people there. So I was thinking of like five or six people. But stroke is a really big overview, and I've broken every single rule. I have too many lines per slide. I have too many slides and too much to say. You guys can all have a copy of these slides. I don't know if you get them or not, but you're more than welcome to. I'd rather you just listen. And please ask whatever questions you want, because this is my view of stroke, based on the criteria that Nicole limited me to, because she's going to be talking about some things afterwards. These are my disclosures. I guess the bottom four disclosures are now in several national and international committees promoting stroke guidelines, so I guess I have a conflict of interest on saying what we think is the best treatment for stroke. So we'll start off with transient ischemic attack, because before you have a stroke, most people have transient ischemic attacks. And the old definition of that is any focal cerebral ischemic event with symptoms lasting less than 24 hours. So it would be if a person had an episode of loss of vision, numbness, tingling, weakness on one side of their body that lasted for less than 24 hours. We used to call that a TIA, and we still call it TIA, and 95% of the population calls it TIA. More recently, in 2005, with the development of new technologies such as MRI, when they started doing MRIs on all these TIA patients, they noticed that some of them, while their symptoms went away, still had evidence of damage to the brain or ischemia to the brain, in which case it's technically a stroke, which is the next definition we'll get to. So when you look at people with TIAs, around 30 to 50% of them, even though their symptoms have gone away within 24 hours, actually have evidence of a stroke or permanent fixed damage to the brain. So when you get all these little warning symptoms and you see it was just a warning sign, well, there's still some damage going on to your brain, which is not a good thing to have. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. But by definition, is any focal ischemic event to the brain, to the eye, or to the spinal cord, any part of the central nervous system lasting less than 24 hours without evidence of any damage to the brain on an MRI would be the new definition of TIA. And it really doesn't matter, because I think all patients should be treated the same. For those of you, like Nicole said, there's going to be senior members of the department and people who've been doing this for 30 years in the audience. You may have heard of a term RIND, which is a reversible ischemic neurological deficit. We don't use this term anymore. It's gone. It's been abolished. You may see it in your books or in the literature. And it really referred to people who had neurological symptoms, focal neurological symptoms, that lasted for more than 24 hours, but sort of disappeared by 3 days. And for some reason, in the 1960s and 1970s and even the 1980s, people thought maybe that was a subgroup of people that got better within 72 hours and may have a different either pathology or pathophysiology what caused the stroke, or had a different prognosis. And we know, again, that's not true. If you get better, that's great. If you don't get better, that's not good. When we talk about symptoms, thank you so much. So when we talk about symptoms of TIA, and they're basically the same symptoms as stroke. If you have hemiparesis, weakness on one side of the body, sensory loss on one side of the body, difficulty pronouncing your words, which would be a dysarthria, as opposed to a problem of language, which would be an aphasia, if you have double vision, if you have unsteadiness, not vertigo, the room spinning around, but true unsteadiness when you balance or ataxia, and if you lose vision in one eye, those are all signs really concerning for a TIA, and if they last more than 24 hours, we would call it a stroke. I get lots of consults every day, and probably 90% of the consults I get called to see in the emergency room are not TIA or strokes. And these are people who have altered consciousness. You know, to really alter your consciousness, if you don't have any aphasia, you probably had a seizure or some metabolic abnormality, but to suggest that you didn't have enough blood flow through your carotid arteries in the front and your vertebral arteries in the back to either lose consciousness all at the same time is incredibly unlikely. So it's really not a symptom of TIA. People who are incontinent of bowel or bladder dysfunction, again, any stroke or TIA is a focal neurological deficit. When people have pins and needles in their hands and feet, not a sign of TIA. Grayouts. Tons of people come to the emergency room. They feel woozy. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. It's like, hi, can you come to the emergency room at 3 o'clock in the morning? This person had a grayout where they didn't see well in both eyes. Yes? Grayout is when people sort of feel like a little bit woozy, like they're going to faint, or their vision sort of gets a little blurry or gray, so they see hazy in both of their eyes at the same time. A sensory march. This is probably one of the most important things we get on history, not only in people who have migraine or seizures. When people have a sensory march, so people will sort of feel some tingling in their fingertips, and then they slowly walks up their arm and takes 2 or 3 minutes to go to their face. You see that with seizures sometimes. And why is everyone typing? We see it with seizures sometimes, and you also see it in people with migraine, which is probably one of the biggest stroke mimics. When you have a stroke, you have a lack of blood flow to the part of the brain. So in neurology, we talk about positive phenomena, tingling, burning, sort of positive things, as opposed to negative phenomena, which would be a loss of sensation. So whenever someone has pins and needles, it's kind of an unusual symptom for having a stroke because it's a positive phenomenon. Usually people lose sensation. You lose your strength. You lose your vision. So we sort of try to divide things into what we call positive phenomena, tingling, flashing lights, or negative phenomena being weakness or loss of sensation. Dizziness, loss of consciousness, amnesia are really not causes of stroke. Confusion and tonic-clonic activity. So tonic-clonic activity really refers to a seizure. And confusion, or people come in confused for a lot of different reasons, but for the most part, those really aren't signs of either a TIA or of a stroke. There's lots of things that mimic TIAs and or strokes. So one of them would be a brain tumor, where a slowly expanding mass in your brain finally causes some weakness. It's usually, though, more permanent. People with migraine can get loss of vision on one side, numbness. How many of you get migraine here? And how many of you have ever had numbness, tingling? Just the old people.
So
people with migraine can actually lose their vision, they can slur their speech, they can even be confused, they can even be paralyzed on one side of their body. The difference is that in a stroke, it's sudden in onset, and in migraine, it's a slow sensory march. Do any of you know where the term stroke came from? Who coined the term stroke? Do you know?
No.
So stroke was first described by Socrates. And when people were walking along, these older people usually, which in those days was like 30 or 40 years of age, and they would suddenly fall to the ground and they'd be paralyzed on one side. And the concept was that they were stricken down by the gods, that they were punished for doing something bad, and they were stricken down by the gods. And that's where stroke originally was described. Other things that can cause or mimic TIAs would be multiple sclerosis. So people with MS are usually younger. They can mimic TIA. Sometimes it's a little bit different, right? They can mimic stroke because it's going to be a permanent deficit, but it's something else to think about. People with very high or very low blood sugars sometimes can get focal neurological deficits, such as blurry vision, weakness on one side of the body. Individuals with panic attacks always complain of numbness, tingling. They may slur their speech, something that's a little bit hard to distinguish sometimes. And the last one is a radiculopathy. So an individual with a pinched nerve in their neck, and they have pain shooting into their right arm. And they can get weakness as a result of that, and they get sensory changes with that. The things that are unusual is that it's a positive phenomenon. You usually get pain. Strokes aren't painful. In fact, if you go to an emergency room and you see somebody with a cut finger, they'll have 10 people around them. If you see someone paralyzed in a bed, you're going to have nobody around them. Because people are pretty not aware of what's going on. People see blood, they think it's a lot more important. So pain is an unusual symptom of stroke. It doesn't exist. You should always think of something else. So TIAs are not a benign process. So these little mini warning strokes are actually very important because around 10 to 20% of people after a TIA will have a stroke in the next 90 days. Not a great statistic. 50% of those people, however, will have their event in the next 24 to 48 hours. This is all leading up to the urgency of evaluating these people and why specialized units, which we're going to talk about, are so important in terms of preventing this from happening. Most TIAs resolve within 30 minutes. Almost 95%+ of them within 60 minutes. So it's really a short-lived thing. And if you remember, the definition is less than 24 hours, as long as they don't have evidence of any damage to the brain on an MRI. If we look at people who have symptoms lasting more than 3 hours, it's only around 2% of them that are actually going to get better. So once your symptoms are at 3 hours, most likely this is going to be a fixed deficit for these people. Yes?
Would you say that healthcare doesn't usually see TIAs?
So the the statistic is that for every one confirmed stroke that you see in the ER, there's probably around 8 or 9 people who had a TIA or a mild stroke that never present to the emergency room. So when we look at the 50,000 strokes a year that are in Canada, that number is probably a lot higher, although a lot of these people that finally present with a stroke are probably the ones that have had these little events beforehand. So the answer is yes. We know how many people actually have events that we label. We don't know how many people are walking in the community that have had little events and have never been investigated for. In fact, when I see patients in the ER, when I interrogate them, because they usually don't tell you the truth when you answer them, but like on the fourth time with the light bulb in their face, you ask them, like, you know, well, they'll say, you know what, I had some like clumsiness in my hand for a couple of minutes while I was writing, or, you know, I was at a bar and I hadn't started drinking yet, and my friends thought it was really funny because I was slurring my speech even before I had a drink. And you get a lot of these stories. So there are really a lot of warning signs. And these are important because this is a preventable disease. If you go for rapid evaluation that we're going to talk about, we can probably decrease the number of events by 80%, which is a huge benefit to people. So this is the most embarrassing part of my talk. So I did a 2-year stroke fellowship and a year of neuromuscular neurorehab disease. And I've never come across the definition of stroke because everyone sort of knew what it was. And I started going through the Canadian Best Practice Guidelines and the American Heart and Stroke Foundation and the National Stroke Association and everybody, and nobody really defines this. Everybody sort of automatically assumes you know what it is. And the definitions I found weren't very good. So a stroke or cerebrovascular accident, and I'm telling you this is not an accident, this is something that is very preventable, is a disturbance of blood supply to the brain, but more importantly it's a focal disturbance of blood supply to the brain that's either caused by ischemia, meaning a blocked artery, or from hemorrhage, it means that you're bleeding from that artery. And the things, this was the most general definition that's out there, but all the definitions are really a layman's definition. And besides our definitions that we use on a daily basis of a fixed neurological deficit due to focal ischemia of the brain, there's not very good definitions out there, and I was kind of surprised by that. So I want to go into the different types of stroke. All of you guys work in the hospitals, been in the hospital? Nobody? Yes? Okay. So I'm going to go through some of the common terminology that's out there. And it's kind of important because it gives the clinician a potential cause for what the stroke is and will change our treatment. And also some of these different stroke types may have different prognoses or therapies. So when we look at stroke, we think of ischemic stroke. So that's a blocked artery, no bleeding in the brain. And then there's hemorrhagic stroke, which is around 20% of strokes, which is bleeding in the brain. The causes of hemorrhagic stroke are a subarachnoid hemorrhage, which is an aneurysm that ruptures. And I'm going to show you pictures of all this, really just to put this all into framework for you. And intracerebral hemorrhages, which are just a spontaneous artery that bursts deep down in the brain. Unfortunately, 1 in 4 strokes, we never find the cause. Cardioembolic strokes, individuals with abnormalities of the heart. They've had a heart attack, their heart doesn't contract well. They can form a clot in the heart, and it can fly off and end up in the brain. These are usually more severe strokes, and they're usually associated with some mild bleeding with them. We have lacunar strokes. These are little baby strokes. They're less than 1.5 centimeters in size by definition, and we commonly see them in people with diabetes or high blood pressure. And when they're not diagnosed with those entities, we know that we really need to go and treat them. And then we have thromboembolic stroke. So by that, we mean that an individual in the carotid artery, for example, can develop a fatty deposit there, and a little bit of that fat can fly off and just occlude an artery distally and cause some ischemia there. And I'm going to show you pictures of these to put them into perspective. So we're going to talk about lacunar stroke. So this is you guys all do anatomy and OT? Yeah. Sorry, stupid question.
No, that's fine. The other thing I forgot to mention to you is I took your slideshow and I posted it on their course.
Really?
So that's why they're typing. They're adding notes to your... Now, I didn't ask you.
Well, I was going to be selling the fucking lobby afterwards, but that's fine. So we have the carotid artery that comes all the way up, and then it branches into your anterior cerebral artery over here and your middle cerebral artery here, which really supplies 2/3 of the brain with its blood supply. So off your middle cerebral artery, you get these little branches that go deep, deep down into the brain, and then they branch off the little branches, which do not branch off to these other little branches. And when these little branches get occluded, usually in diabetes and high blood pressure, they give you what are called lacunar strokes. And on an MRI, this little dot here, you see that little white dot there? Everyone's straining their eyes. So that would be a typical lacunar stroke, this little dot. It's deep down, it's in the white matter, and it's almost always caused by diabetes and high blood pressure. When we talk about thromboembolic strokes, you can get some fat that's developing in your middle cerebral artery or even in your carotid artery, which you would see here. And you can either occlude the artery completely, where a blood clot forms in this little fatty deposit. For those of you that didn't eat healthy at lunch, this is what's going on right now. And this can happen to you at any time. And so this can fly off, and it either may give you a little lacunar stroke, but usually it's going to knock off one of these branches and give you a slightly larger stroke. And here's an example on a CT scan of a slightly larger stroke. Finally, the last type of stroke that you'll see on this slide, at least, is from carotid stenosis. So predominantly in Caucasians and people in North America and Western Europe, people get fatty deposits in their carotid artery. And it builds up, and it either occludes your carotid artery completely. It can send little things called emboli, little pieces of fat flying off that go into your eye, so you lose vision in your eye. You may have heard the term amaurosis fugax, which is a loss of vision in one eye. Or it can send off a clot and cause a stroke like this. So do you know why it's doing that, Nicole? So this is actually from one of my patients who's kind enough to volunteer their carotid artery plaque. We actually go inside and remove the fat from the artery when it's more than 70% blocked and take it out. And you can see that this whole fatty thing really molds itself to the shape of the artery. So that's one reason why we should eat healthy. Leukoareosis. So we talked about these little baby arteries being occluded. And so when you have lots of little lacunes, a lot of these little baby strokes here, here, all this white stuff you see here and here and here, and on this entire area over here, these are all the little baby arteries being occluded. And on MRI, you can see this very clearly. And now that's been associated with memory problems. It's been associated with what in the old days was called Binswanger's disease or vascular dementia. And these are things that we really want to try to avoid. Again, primary prevention by controlling hypertension and blood pressure is the way that we try to stop the progression of leukoareosis. If you want me to slow down or stop, just tell me. So when we talk about strokes, we talk about ischemic stroke, which you can see here as being a blocked artery. And this is a classic example of what would happen to the brain and what we would see on a CT scan. You'd also have occlusion of the middle cerebral artery. You can actually see the clot in the artery right here, this little white line here. You can also get a hemorrhagic stroke. So there's several types of hemorrhagic stroke. Sometimes you can have an ischemic stroke like this, but because there's so much breakdown of the blood-brain barrier, you start to bleed a little bit into it. And you're going to see what a real bleed is. But this would be an ischemic stroke that then the sort of the blood started going back there again, but it sort of just spilled into the brain a little bit. So sometimes you can have an ischemic stroke that then bleeds into it. And that happens in around 2 to 3% of large strokes. We can also get bleeding into the brain. And this is what a true bleed in the brain looks like. It's this big blob of blood that's there. Obviously, this person didn't survive because they gave us this picture over here on autopsy. And you can see this huge clot of blood that's in the person's brain. There's things that cause bleeding in the brain as high blood pressure, number one culprit. Number two is people are on Coumadin, a blood thinner. And it gets overtreated, it's too high, and they'll bleed. You can have vascular malformations, which there's an abnormal connection of arteries and veins in the brain. You can get trauma from car accidents. And there's something called amyloidosis, or cerebral amyloidosis. This we're just learning about on MRI, and this is an MRI of a person. You can look for what are called microbleeds. And what we see here is an MRI of someone's brain. And what we look for is when blood breaks down, the thing that's in your blood cell, in your red blood cell, is iron. So we can look for old iron deposits. And some people have tons of, see all these little black dots are all evidence of all these old bleeds. And what's interesting about amyloid is people tend to have lots of bleeds that they're never symptomatic from. And we don't really understand it, but we do know that these people are very susceptible from dying from an intracerebral hemorrhage. And we're very cautious when having to give them Coumadin because it can cause death. The other type of bleeding is a subarachnoid hemorrhage. So a subarachnoid hemorrhage is formed by an aneurysm, which is a bubble that forms at the bifurcation of two arteries, so where two arteries branch off. It tends to give blood all around the brain, and this is what we would see on CT scan, sort of diffuse white blood all around. This is always from aneurysms is the cause, sometimes from trauma, and the treatment is to clip the aneurysm that's bleeding it. And so it's actually a process that's outside of the brain, not inside the brain. That's probably might be burning my jacket going on. If anyone wants to answer it, by all means. So the other types of bleeding are all here. So we have bleeding in the brain, what we call an intracerebral hemorrhage, which is directly into the brain. If you remember your anatomy, we have something called the dura. So you have your scalp, and then you have this canvassy layer all around the brain. If you bleed underneath the dura, you get what's called a subdural hematoma. We have lots of little bridging veins from the skull through the dura, and that gives you, when people get older and their vein sort of sags down because it's shrinking up, when they're in car accidents or have these neck flexion extension movements that are too quickly, you get these shear forces that tear these bridging veins, which can cause you to bleed sort of underneath the dura. So here's a great example of a subdural hematoma, and this is following the dura, which really connects here at the fox on both sides. Does anybody know what this is? That's an epidural hematoma, and that's what Natasha Richardson had. So she fractured her skull and tore her middle meningeal artery. And so the dura is on the inside of this, and I think I have, here's the dura over here, and here you have your subdural hematoma. But here you have the dura that's on this side over here, and the blood's forming between the skull and the dura. So they're on different sides. The difference is that this is caused by an arterial bleed from your epidural, from your middle meningeal artery. And these are all veins that are bleeding sort of a lot slower. So you have a lot greater chance of dying from this than you do from this, which is usually a slower process. So is this helpful to you guys? Okay. So why, going back a couple of slides, as I said, it was important to diagnose the type of stroke because it really changes the prognosis for the person. And this is a slide from the journal Stroke. And do you know why? I'm sorry, Nicole.
It's my Kingston. It's where I touch your tower.
It's okay.
But I don't know why it's doing.
So we have different types of stroke. We have large artery atherosclerosis, which comes from carotid artery disease, and I showed you that plaque that was removed. We have cardioembolic stroke that comes from the heart. Some people have an irregular heartbeat called atrial fibrillation. Some people may have had a heart attack in the past and have a blood clot just sitting at the bottom of their heart. We have small artery occlusion, which is lacunar disease. So if you look at and then you have undetermined etiology, which is another common thing. But if you look at the individuals with lacunar stroke, these little baby strokes, they sort of have the best prognosis. When you look at people with cardioembolic stroke, they have the worst prognosis. If you look with people with, which one do we do? Undetermined, well, it's variable what happens with those people. And so it's just important for us to try to figure this out in order to give a better perspective on what the future holds for our patients. So worldwide, stroke is the second leading cause of death. It's the third leading cause of death in North America and the Western world, but there's this big, as people live longer in third world countries, more of them are having stroke. It's the number one leading cause of disability. We have over 50,000 strokes a year in Canada. That's around a stroke every 10 minutes. And we have around 14,000 people that die from stroke. But more importantly, the bad thing about stroke is that people survive with the deficits and disability. And that's at least 300,000 people at any time. So the prevalence would be around 300,000 of people living with stroke. If we look here in Quebec, since we've just looked at these statistics, we have 11,062 stroke hospitalizations between 2011 and 2012. So in Quebec, we have a stroke every 78 minutes. And what was asked before is estimated that for every identified stroke, there are 9 silent ones that go on. So the numbers are probably a lot greater, just people with more minor symptoms, and maybe they present later on with more severe disability. The point that I'll make to you and that you should tell your friends is that this is a preventable disease, as long as you can identify the signs and symptoms of it and get treated appropriately. Mortality is anywhere from 13 to 50%. The majority of people are over age 75. Interestingly, there's a little bit more in Quebec, less than age 65, than those between 65 and 74 that have stroke. But again, it's a disease that affects all people. And epidemiologically, if you look at the incidence of stroke, it's a pretty flat line. And then at one point, when you get old, in my definition, is when the risk of stroke gets up. Do you know at what age you start becoming old in my eyes? 45. And that's when epidemiologically it gets worse. I'm only going to have this one slide here on costs because Nicole will be talking to you about that shortly. But at least in direct costs in Canada, we spend around $3.5 billion. The numbers are a lot higher because that's only the direct cost. Canadians spend around 4.5 million days or use 4.5 million hospital days. So that's a lot of time in the hospital that these people spend. So I'm telling you stroke is an emergency because the longer you wait to get treated, the more damage is done to your brain. So for each minute you lose not getting blood recirculating to that area, you lose 1.9 million brain cells, almost 14 billion synapses, and 12 kilometers of axons. So those are a lot of brain cells to lose. We have over 100 billion brain cells. My 12-year-old looked it up last night and told me because he was trying to figure out when you're left with no cells left. So, when we look at stroke outcome, we look at several scales. And so I was asked to comment on some scales, and probably the most common one that we use is the modified Rankin scale. And this is the one you'll see in most of the literature as to how independent people are. And it's if you want to look at it, I always remember the 0 and the 6, because 0 means you have no symptoms, and 6 means you're dead, and that's easy to remember. A 1 means that you have no significant disability, and you can really do everything you want. A 2 would be a slight disability, and you can't carry out all the previous activities, but you can do everything on your own. Once you get to a 3, it's a moderate, and you require help with things, and this could be anything. And 4 would be a moderate severe disability, but now you can't walk without assistance, so the gait is really an important thing, and you can't attend to your own bodily functions. And then 5 would be severe disability or bedridden. When you look at the literature, this is going to be the most common outcome measure you're going to see as whether a patient's doing well or not. And in the old days, we used to say 0 or 1 would be a positive trial or a good quality of life, and now a lot of trials are saying 0 to 2 would be a clinically meaningful outcome. So that's one common outcome scale that you'll see. The two other scales that we see not as commonly as we used to would be the Barthel Index, where the higher the score, the better off you are, and the Scandinavian Stroke Scale, which I haven't really used very much, but again, the higher the score, the less severe your symptoms are. And for most trials, we usually use the Rankin and the Barthel to look at outcome of people to see if any treatment is successful. There's also the FIM scale, which is now being broken down into the Alpha FIM, and that's important because it's one of the proposed new scales that are going to be used in Quebec if the current submission to the Ministry of Health is accepted on how to triage our people in terms of available supportive rehab services. So the Alpha FIM is like the FIM, and it's looking at 4 motor items and 2 cognitive ones, and basically if your score is greater than 80, it's going to be called a mild stroke. 61 to 80 would be a moderate stroke, 40 to 60 severe, and then less than 40 is very severe. And I'm going to show you some of the new Quebec stroke strategy to see what's going to be done with these people, because we're going to try to use this to triage how much rehab time people should be eligible for, or what chances we're going to give them to try to recuperate from their stroke. So what happens after a stroke? Well, unfortunately, 15% of people die. And that statistic really hasn't changed for the last 20, 30 years. If we look at long-term care, around 10% end up there. Only 10% have a complete recovery. 25% have minor impairment. And 40% have moderate to severe impairment. So statistically, you have a 2/3 chance of having a really bad outcome from your stroke, either dying or requiring a lot of assistance with everything. So stroke is a very preventable disease. And in my term, I hate the term CVA because everybody implies this was a cerebrovascular accident. There was nothing we could do about it. And Nicole will be talking to you about risk factors. But if we actually treated all risk factors appropriately, we could decrease stroke by around 70 to 75%. Unfortunately, it's changing lifestyles and treating these risk factors. That's not always so easy. When we see people with TIA, our biggest concern is that, hey, these people are going to go on to have a stroke. And the most important thing is to evaluate these people as quickly as possible. And when we say how quickly, we have a scale called the ABCD2 score that we can use to sort of estimate what the risk of someone having a stroke in the next 48 hours. And if you remember, I told you 10 to 20% of people have a stroke in 90 days, but 50% of them will have them in the next 48 hours. So how can we tease out who those people are, and then what treatments do we need to give them? So the ABCD score works as follows. If your age is greater than 60, you get a point. If your blood pressure at presentation is greater than 140 over 90, you get a point. If clinically you have weakness or you had a problem with speech, you can get 2 points or 1 point. If you have both, you just get 2 points. The duration of symptoms is very important. Remember, I told you most TIAs are gone within 30 minutes. The majority are in 60 minutes. And then 2% of people can have symptoms resolved over the next 24 hours. So you get different amount of points depending on what the duration of your symptoms were. And then if you have diabetes is a bad predictor of outcome. If you have a stroke and present to the emergency room with a blood sugar of greater than 10, your chances of having a good recovery are diminished by a third. Your chances of bleeding into your brain are probably up by around 20%. I didn't mention this before, but when we talk about stroke, there's really ischemic stroke, blocked artery, mortality is 15%. If you bleed into your brain, though, your mortality is 50%. So 50% of people with bleeds in the brain die. So we have this little scale here that can help us figure out who's at high risk. If you score 0 to 3 on your ABCD score, you see whether it's at 2 days or at 90 days, your risk of having a stroke is pretty low and stays at 1%. Once you're at 4 to 5 or 6 to 7, you can see that the numbers are much higher. So currently, it's suggested that anybody who has a TIA and has an ABCD2 score of 4 or greater should go straight to the emergency room and have evaluations done immediately. The evidence in the literature for that is from 2 trials. Yes?
Who's referring to the ABCD?
You.
Or me as an individual?
No, anybody. So it should be done by it should be a community physician, so not to berate OTs, PTs, or anybody else. So the guidelines suggest that anybody having a TIA should be evaluated by a physician immediately. And if the family doctor in the community or the ER doctor finds an ABCD score of 4 or greater, they should be evaluated immediately. So this is something for an emergency room or a primary care clinic or in rural areas where there's just a nurse or a nurse practitioner for them to do in order to try to triage who's most important and who's least important since we have such limited resources. You know, if you're at a party or at a wedding and someone has slurred speech for an hour and weakness on one side and you write a note, ABCD score 6, go to the emergency room, I think that's great. But these people really need to be seen in a hospital setting or what we're going to call a stroke prevention clinic in order to get their investigations done as quickly as possible. I think time is what's the most important thing to do. Is that okay? If I don't answer your questions and I talk a lot, just tell me through answering. So there were 2 studies done, and in classic political correctness, there was a study done in England, and there's a study done in France. And one was called the Express Trial, and one was called the SOS-TIA Trial. And their point was to see if you evaluate people with TIAs really quickly, can you do anything to change their prognosis? And the answer is yes. So this is just one of the trials, the Express Trial, and let me explain to you phase one of the trial. Phase one, the British did what they do great. They watched everybody come into the emergency room, they recorded all of the data, and then they watched them have a stroke. And after doing that for around 10 years, they decided, well, maybe we should do something to try to decrease the rates of stroke. So after watching these people have strokes and doing absolutely nothing for them, they found that around 10% of their patients had strokes at 90 days. Then somebody said, well, let's treat them. Let's do all the tests, which I'm going to go over in a second, and let's put them on the best medications we think there are. And let's do it all within 24 hours. And they did that, and the stroke rate went from 10.3% to around 2%. That's an 80% reduction just by evaluating people quickly. Thank God, a study done in France had the exact same results, and it was very supportive. 2 large randomized trials in 2 separate countries were able to show that individuals had better outcome when evaluated and treated within 24 hours. And so, big p-value. You only need to evaluate 12 people in order to prevent 1 major stroke, which is a great number needed to treat. If you are found to have a carotid blockage, remember I showed you that fatty plaque from the carotid artery? Well, if your carotid is blocked more than 70%, your risk here goes up to 35%. So that's 1 in 3 people with a carotid blockage will have a stroke within those 90 days. And the sooner you do that surgery to clean out that artery, the better off you are. So that's probably the strongest evidence we have out there, that rapid evaluation of TIA patients could help prevent events from happening. So this means that I'm on slide 20, which means I'm bored and my attention span is diminished. So one of the advantages of traveling along around the world is you get invited to all these really interesting or not so interesting places. And so I got invited to South Korea. Somehow my oldest son convinced my wife that I was going to North Korea, and she accepted it. So this is the hotel I stayed at, which is from the outside, and this is the main lobby. And then they were nice. They had this girl, Soup Lee, that followed me everywhere to show me where everything was. This was the gym, and this is the pool. This is the bathroom in my suite, which was really nice. And this is the bar. They had a rock climbing wall there. And then this was my welcome meal, which was for 1, by the way. And my wife calls me, and she says, I hope you have a good time. My son, who somehow managed to find some hotel in North Korea, was showing her pictures of I don't know what, says, I hope you're going to be comfortable there. And I said, don't worry. So, I work at St. Mary's Hospital and the Montreal General Hospital. How many of you have been to St. Mary's? Good. So, St. Mary's is an older version of the Montreal General Hospital. So, right across the street from my hotel was the Catholic University Hospital in Seoul, where I was going to go give a talk the next day. And so the next day I went to the hospital, and I met Dr. Kim, Dr. Lee, and Dr. Koo, and my entire 16-hour flight to Korea. Does anybody speak Korean here? No way. My entire flight to Korea, I always like to speak the language, and Korean is really hard to learn, so I can only learn two words. One was 안녕하세요, which was hello, believe it or not. And so I get out of the car that picked me up, and they beat me there, and I decided, I'm going to say the first word in Korea. So I did that, which was a mistake, because then they said this, which I had no idea, and I had this little Samsung simultaneous Korean-English translator. So they said that to me, which meant, welcome to St. Mary's Hospital. So then I typed back in the following, and then they said this. It says, we hope you feel home at your sister hospital. And I walk into the lobby, and I decide to answer them, doing this as quickly as possible, saying, Yeongyang Jimgat Kuyum, which is very important to say, which means, this place feels like home. So I walk into this hospital, and I said, it looks just like St. Mary's Hospital. And I couldn't believe how nice it was. And this was a picture from the stroke unit, wow, looking into the main atrium. They apologized because the piano player had to leave. And then we went, this was the rehab floor. This is off their website, because you're not taking pictures, which they got angry at. And this is their stroke unit, which is a dedicated unit where people only deal with stroke patients, and we're going to go get into that. I was also there because I serve on the editorial board for the Journal of Clinical Neurology. And there was this article that showed that individuals who are admitted to South Korean hospitals on the weekend have just as good a prognosis as those that are treated during the week. And I thought that was amazing because the guidelines suggest that you should be evaluated within 24 to 48 hours. And how could they do this? And so this was the resident. This is the resident. And Dr. Koo, who was on the other page, I said, guys, how did you get such good results? And they had two answers for me. They said, first of all, they have a little telemedicine robot that sort of zooms around the hospital with the guy driving it from home, and they can do telemedicine consults. I said, but how did you get such good outcomes on all your patients? And the guy looks at me, he goes, we follow the Canadian best practice recommendations. So I knew I was in trouble in this institution. So what do? So these are the Canadian best practice recommendations. So first of all, these state that if you have a TIA and you go to your family doctors, you should have immediate clinical evaluation to establish the diagnosis. You should be evaluated within 24 hours and transported to an emergency room. So TIAs are really an emergency room, and it's kind of funny because you should go there when, even if your symptoms have gone away, because you can do something preventative to do it. And our system works the complete opposite. If you have a stroke, you sit in the hospital and they get all the tests done. And if you can walk, they say, okay, someone will call you back and arrange the test. And that's exactly what we should not be doing, and we're slowly changing it here. If you will go to a family doctor's or walk-in clinic, or if you're at the wedding with that young lady over there, you should be sent directly to an emergency room or to a secondary stroke prevention clinic. So the concepts that we're getting to is that ERs or tertiary care centers should do rapid TIA evaluations, but we should also have in the community primary and secondary stroke prevention centers that have the resources to evaluate people rapidly in order to prevent them from having strokes. So we start off with the ambulance. If you have a TIA or stroke, it's suggested that you should, A, call 911, not drive in on your own, because people that drive in on their own have worse prognosis than those coming by ambulance. And number two is ambulances should have designated hospitals that are specialized in stroke care that can follow the Canadian best practice recommendations and then administer all recommendations within the 24 hours. So what do we do in the emergency room, or what does an emergency room doctor do? Well, first of all, our ABCs, which is just your airway, breathing, and circulation. We're supposed to do baseline stroke scales to assess what the severity of symptoms are. That could be the NIH stroke scale or the Canadian Neurological Scale. You want to have the guidelines suggest that there should be an evaluation of swallowing in the emergency room as soon as possible, or at least a screening. The patient should be put on telemetry to look for irregular heartbeats, and individuals should have standard blood work done. The most important things to do is do a CT scan of the brain and make sure we're actually dealing with a stroke or a TIA, and that we don't have a brain tumor or something that mimics it. And the most important thing to do is your carotid Doppler. We want to know who has that blockage in their carotid artery. The guidelines suggest that if you have 70% blockage and you've had symptoms of a stroke, that your surgery should be done within 2 weeks. And in fact, when we look at differences between men and women, Women had no benefit to getting that artery cleaned out 2 weeks after the stroke, whereas men were a little bit lazier. We can hang out to around 3 months, and that's our window of opportunity. Cardiovascular investigations. People should have daily EKGs looking for irregular heartbeats that would change the medications we use. They should be on a heart monitor, and they should have an ultrasound of the heart. Blood pressure is another thing. And it always bothers me when PTs and OTs and even the nurses say, you know, we can't do a test because their blood pressure is too high. You know, you should still do therapies. There's no evidence that doing your exercise or doing your evaluation is going to make them worse. We don't bring blood pressure down by more than around 25% a day. And for the most part, we don't treat it unless it's higher than those numbers. So the brain needs extra circulation in the acute phase. And I don't think, unless it's really above those numbers, I'm not sure it should really impair you from conducting your evaluations. One of the common causes of stroke is an irregular heartbeat called atrial fibrillation. And I bring it up now because there's all these new medications out there for atrial fibrillation, and with the drug companies, they sort of promote it, and there seems to be an epidemic of it now. So we can actually tell sometimes by looking at a scan or an MRI that something is a cardioembolic stroke, or it's come from the heart. They tend to be strokes that are shaped like a piece of pie, what we call a wedge-shaped infarct. And if you have an artery sort of goes to an area and then it puts branches out everywhere, that's why you would get that wedge-shaped infarct. And we also think of people having strokes coming from the heart when there's more than one stroke. So if you have a clot in your heart that then flies up your aorta and sort of showers all over the place, you can get blood clots on the right and left side of the brain. So when we see individuals who have strokes on both sides of the brain, like you see here, those little dark areas, that would be highly suspicious that this person had a cardioembolic event and would push us to look for other causes for the stroke if we didn't detect anything on our initial investigation. The only therapy out there to treat acute stroke is a drug called TPA. TPA is a drug that breaks up blood clots. In the old days, we used to use a drug called urokinase, and it was done in Australia. They actually treated people within 12 hours. The good news was that if you got urokinase and you survived, you had a 50% chance of going home the next day. The bad news is that 40 to 50% of people died from the drug. So we've been trying to find a balance. So right now, the time window is 4.5 hours. So anybody presenting to an emergency room within 4.5 hours of having focal neurological symptoms suggestive of an ischemic stroke, a blocked artery, can get this medication. Nationally, only around 2% of people actually get it. In areas with designated stroke centers and designated referral centers, around 20 to 30% of people get this medication. Calgary is a great example. It's a new city. They don't have a growing population. They have one tertiary care center where almost everybody with a stroke is referred to. And they're treating around 35% of their patients with TPA because they get there to a designated center on time.
I'm
going to
make a comment.
Yes.
So from now on, from this day forward, you will all have a piece of knowledge that could change something not only for your patients, but for your family members, etc., for neighbors, etc. If you ever need to go to a marriage with somebody who has any of these symptoms, they will likely, unless they're at one of the designated sites, sit the person in the waiting room and, as Dr. Lee has pointed out, take care of the bleeding person. I have done this in my own personal experience for friends and family on our street. You need to say, I want this patient evaluated for TPA potential. If you say that one sentence, they look like my friend who's in the clothing business had no clue what she was saying, but I'm on the phone saying, you just say that to the resident. They'll get nervous and things will change. And I will show you during this course the gentleman who benefited from no longer being left lying half slouched in a chair in the ER of one of our hospitals. So that was one thing that Dr. Wing just taught you that can change things forever for you, just knowing that one piece. Because sometimes we do things as therapists and clinicians, but we also do it as forever knowing something for our own. And share that with your friends.
So a lot of you are going to, and I'm just going to add on to that, which are great points, is that a lot of you are going to be evaluating patients who are at very high risk or have had a stroke, and the biggest risk for having a second stroke is having a first stroke. And so reality is, when you're evaluating some of your patients, people may have a stroke while you're there. And, you know, the most important thing that we need as clinicians is to find out when it started, because nobody knows. And so if you can mark down the time when the ambulance comes, that's very helpful. And number two is to make your patients aware of the therapy and to call 911. There are other therapies out there trying to expand this 4.5 hour time window. And one of them is to put a stent in to an artery and open it up. And the other one are these little devices called mechanical thrombectomy devices. And what they are, it's a wire that you put up, you thread up the artery, and you actually put it through the blood clot. And the idea is that you can twirl it through the blood clot and then suck the blood clot out. Right now, these devices are on the market. We know that we can do it, but we don't have any data to suggest that it actually improves patient outcome. So these are things that may be seen in the future. The stent, I'm sorry?
What was it called?
It's a mechanical thrombectomy device. Yeah, happy you asked. So there's a whole bunch of different ones on the market. But the concept is that the sooner you can open up the artery and reperfuse the brain, the better off you are. For now, we haven't been able to demonstrate it more than a 4.5 hour time window, and we've only been able to demonstrate it with a medication that breaks up the blood clot. So once you've had all these fancy tests and investigations to try to improve your quality of life, you need to be on medication. So people will be on antiplatelets to quote-unquote thin the blood or prevent platelets from forming further clots, of which we have aspirin, clopidogrel, which is marketed as Plavix, and aspirin dipyridamole, which is marketed as Aggrenox. We have anticoagulants with people who we think had a cardioembolic stroke, where they get warfarin. The other new drugs that are on the market are dabigatran, rivaroxaban, and apixaban. Warfarin was developed at the University of Wisconsin as rat poison. We give it to people, and we have to measure the level, and it's very dependent on the amount of vitamin K you eat, so it's a variable dose requiring frequent monitoring. The new drugs require no monitoring. They're much more expensive, obviously, and warfarin, you can reverse its effects by giving vitamin K and some other blood products. Right now, for the new drugs, we have no means of reversing it, so one of the drawbacks of these new agents. Blood pressure management needs to be treated. We usually put people on Lipitor or a class of drugs called statins to lower cholesterol. And what we forget about, and I'm sure Dr. Korner-Vitensky is going to talk about it, is lifestyle management is a very important aspect of stroke care. So when we look at the future of what stroke services are, we're going to have what are called comprehensive stroke centers. We're going to have hospitals with intermediate stroke services and hospitals without specialized stroke resources. If you show up, the ambulance should not be bringing you here. The ambulance can bring you here or here. The difference between the comprehensive stroke center is that it has to have a neuroradiologist that can try to do that mechanical thrombectomy device, as well as neurosurgery and a neurological intensive care unit to deal with some of the rarer complications of stroke. Otherwise, the majority of hospitals will be hospitals with intermediate stroke service. So these are written protocols in the emergency room, designated people from rehab and the ER, and a dedicated physician service that focuses just on stroke patients. They're able to provide thrombolysis, and they have to be able to provide the criteria for a stroke unit, which I will show you shortly. But most importantly, they have to have a direct corridor to the comprehensive stroke center if their patient is to get worse or they require the intensive care or neurosurgery or neuroradiology to perform other services. So again, time is of the essence. So they have to have predefined protocols in order to establish that these things can be done in a timely fashion. So, acute stroke units, yes.
So
no apologies.
Would TPA be available in the intermediate?
Yes.
And stroke?
Correct.
That's it?
Okay. It's a good question. I should have
and
been clear.
And the stats for that in Montreal right now, we're having a fight about all of this.
It's only been 12 years, but we'll solve it soon.
Because people like treating stroke, and so they do not want to let go and no longer be recognized by the site that receives patients.
Right.
I worked in Southern Ontario, and like they're having a fight about like where the ambulance were taking. Like, yeah, because the ambulance like paramedics weren't sure where to take, or like they had protocols where to take if they suspected stroke. But it wasn't.
So the plan for Quebec is that, as of December 2012, which passed already, but I'm part of a committee that's submitting a report that your boss is going to be the external reviewer for on what these centers are and that they should be implemented immediately. Unfortunately, there's lots of politics involved, and in Ontario, one of the issues was that there were people designated as stroke centers got large sums of money as supplements, which everybody wanted. And the most most important thing is patient stroke care. And right now the plan is that the neuro will be the tertiary care center, or the comprehensive stroke center. The the Jewish and the Montreal General will be the intermediate care stroke centers. And that patients from LaSalle, Lachine, and the Lakeshore are supposed to be funneled in, but that hasn't been worked out yet. So what is an acute stroke unit, or what should be done in the acute setting? So by definition, a stroke unit is a specialized geographical defined hospital unit, so I showed you the picture of the place in Korea, dedicated to the management of stroke patients. So that should be all that these people are doing. Should be a team that has the expertise in stroke, the focus on stroke, the know-how in stroke from an educational perspective. Who's involved in this interdisciplinary team? We have nursing, appropriate physicians, occupational therapy, physiotherapy, speech-language pathology, social work, clinical nutrition, and you may include pharmacy, neuropsychology, which we don't have anymore, and recreation therapy. The interdisciplinary team, so all of these people are supposed to do their evaluations within 48 hours. And we should use standardized assessments. And part of our Quebec stroke strategy is to tell you what those standardized stroke assessments are, which I will show you shortly what we're suggesting. And children should go to a designated child area. So what's so special about stroke units? So in a nutshell, stroke units reduce death and disability by as much as 30%, higher in some other studies. If we do a meta-analysis of stroke units, which is what SU stands for, they report that patients that receive organized patient care in a stroke unit are more likely to live, they're more likely to be independent, and they're more likely to be at home 1 year post-event. And that's what our goal really is social integration, getting people as functional as possible. The problem in the literature is that the nosology or the terminology for stroke unit has really, really changed, and it's been very entertaining for me to watch the change in definitions over the last two decades. So in the literature, there are some stroke units that are a multidisciplinary team that follows patients on different floors of the hospital. Stroke team assigned to a dedicated stroke ward working exclusively with patients for 7 to 10 days. You have some places that are integrated stroke units where you have both acute stroke and rehab being done in the same place, which is my favorite model. And you can just have a stroke unit which can just be the pure rehab side. So when reviewing the literature and looking at outcome, depending on which phase you are, outcome may be very different. If you have a massive stroke, well, you're not going to get out of your stroke unit, and so the survival data is going to look a lot better from the neuro rehab unit. So you have to realize some of these limitations when looking at the literature. Some of the initial stuff on stroke units or stroke teams following people started here in Montreal with Sharon Wood Dauphine, and they had several trials. And they looked at traditional care versus a team approach, 130 patients, and they found that there was no difference. They also had another study where they had their dedicated stroke team that sort of followed people around the hospital, and they didn't find that that was any better either. It was really once we started getting towards a stroke unit, a specific geographical region location, with people just devoted to stroke versus people treated on a general medical ward. And so if you look here, and this is just one study. This one's from Sweden. There's a lot of different ones. But you can see here that fatality was lower in the stroke unit, survival was higher, 18-month survival was higher. Look at the difference. If you had a bleed in your brain and you were on a stroke unit versus a general medical ward, big difference. And 18-month survival was also different. So the specialized units seem to be doing really, really well. This is just to give you odds ratios and look at people going to nursing home or being discharged home. You were like 90% more likely to be discharged home if you were in a stroke unit than you were in a medical ward. So again, these are people, well, let me see if I don't know if I took this out. There's been lots of analyses looking at what makes a stroke unit special or what aspects are really important to have that contribute to it. And nobody's been able to find something that I call convincingly good. The treatments are the same. The evaluations are not as timely in the conventional ward, in the old days at least. But you can see that in, this is from 1997, but multidisciplinary team care approach 19 versus 4. If you look at nursing is integrated with everything, much more common than in a general medical ward. And this is in the UK. I still don't know what careers routinely involved in rehabilitation, but people were more involved. What is it?
Carers.
Oh, it's carers. Is that how you spell carers?
No. Okay. That's why you can't figure it out.
That's right. So education and training. People got routine information. I love giving these talks. I mean so much. Routine information provided to the carers again. Regular staff training. So there's really more of an impetus on people being interested in what they were doing. In fact, some of the studies looked at, you're working on a stroke floor, and the questions were like, are you interested in what you were doing? And so if you look at specialization of staff, nurse interest in rehabilitation, well, in the general medical ward, they didn't really care about it, so is that a reason why people did worse? Physician interest in stroke. If you have an internist taking care of people that's doing heart attack, congestive heart failure, diabetes, you know, if they had less interest, did they actually do a poorer job? Is that a potential difference? Well, potential difference in the staff, whether it accounts for the difference in outcome is unclear. But nursing interest in stroke, huge difference, and physician interest in rehabilitation, which sadly enough, in the organized stroke unit, was only 13 out of 21 people back in 1997. But I think that the key is that if you're interested and you're much more gung-ho on something and up-to-date on the latest literature, you're much more likely to provide better care. In 1997, increased proportion of patients receiving PTOT. Well, a lot more people received them in the stroke unit, but in the studies, only 9 out of 17 people actually got the evaluation, earlier onset of evaluation, and early evaluation of medical investigation. So I think the whole dynamic here is that if you do things rapidly and soon, that you have a better outcome. But there's not one independent factor that's really determined what makes this more effective or less effective. If we look at intensity of rehab, it was more intense in stroke units, more nurses here, but those didn't really explain what the differences are. So in 2009, we have the Cochrane Collaborative. So these people do meta-analysis of just every aspect of medicine, and their conclusion is usually more studies are required. But they actually have some very positive things to say here. So what are the minimal criteria for a successful stroke unit? That would be a dedicated area and a defined unit, interprofessional staff working, which we've already spoken about. They'd be coordinated and have a multidisciplinary rehab approach, that people have specialized interests. So look at the word interest. Is there, you need to be interested in what you're doing. Regular team meetings, routine involvement in the rehab process by everybody. When I was in Texas, we had an integrated stroke unit there. We had the families rounding with us. I mean, the family knew everything that was going on and heard everything, and that was very helpful. Additional things, we need to monitor the treatment. Early rehab, early mobilization is really one of the new strong focuses. But really, rehab should start immediately when people come in. Guidelines suggest that you be on, once you hit the emergency room, that you be within your stroke unit in 3 hours, that your rehab evaluation is within 24 to 48 hours, and people should be in active rehab afterwards, providing they're medically stable. So acute stroke units should be 7 to 8 days max. In the United States now, people are being kicked out in 48 to 72 hours. I'm sorry, Nicole?
Yeah, 3 to 5.
Sure, I won't charge you extra.
The last part, he's going over here. So I just wanted to make a point because Dr. Wien is presenting data that we have seen for 10 years, that if you roam around the hospital as a rehab professional, it doesn't seem to do the trick in terms of patient outcome. And yet, when we have all this data, we as a Canadian group interested in stroke did not have specialty courses for rehab. So that's why last year we put in a request for this course at McGill, and that's why we want to get it modular, so that all levels of clinicians at one point will have a summer program that they can, you know, take the modular and then come and have intensive training. Because you could say all this stuff about the unit should have stroke, people who are rehab specialists interested in, but there's no university in Canada that is creating stroke specialists. So that you're the first day.
Really, a lot of shoes to fill. So, integrated stroke units are basically the same as acute stroke units, but you have the component of rehab that's in there. And just for you guys, you have all the criteria or inclusion criteria for that. So, the Quebec Stroke Strategy, which I'm part of, our mandate was to figure out what's the best way to evaluate these patients and sort of establish a new standardized government norm to really help implement the Canadian best practice recommendations and what needs to be changed, along with what we thought were the best tools to use, since there's many tools out there. So these are things that we've proposed to the government through various, I think there's like 18 people on my committee, on what should be done or what we think should be done. So in the hyperacute phase, when you're in the emergency room, it's felt that the CNS, the Canadian Neurological Scale, should be done. The NIH Stroke Scale, which we use almost exclusively to see if people are eligible for to receive TPA. We want to do a modified Rankin Scale to see what their baseline function was even prior to coming. The TorVest is what we've proposed for swallowing evaluation, despite some of its limitations, as well as the cost relationship to do it. And it's been recommended that we have some quality of life measure. So we do all these things, but I think the most important thing of a stroke unit, and to what Nicole just mentioned before, is constantly learning, is to be able to constantly reevaluate yourself and see what you're doing good, what you're doing poorly, as well as what's having impact on patients' lives. So this I cut and pasted from a document that Nicole has in her office that she'll be reviewing shortly. And so it's in French, which I'm sure is fine with all of you. So the question is, what should we do acutely? So the guidelines suggest that after 3 hours, you should be up in the stroke unit already. So the hyperacute thing was for really the ER evaluation, what we expect. And so we wanted a more formal evaluation of swallowing if the TorVest wasn't done. Again, the NIH Stroke Scale and Canadian Neurological Stroke Scale. The Rankin is important. We need some sort of style of life test. The AlphaFIM is going to become the new standard that we're proposing to the government to help triage people on where they're going to go to rehab. The MOCA for cognitive assessment, which finally has been recognized as an impairment from stroke. When I was a resident and I took my Royal College of Physicians exam, the two things that struck me most was, my question was, if you have a patient with a stroke, what treatment would you give them? And I would say one aspirin. And then they said, if you had a second stroke, what would you do? And the answer was two aspirin. And then if you had a third stroke, what would you do? Is, well, you'd give three aspirins. And then my last question is, if you had four strokes, you're supposed to give four aspirins, but consult gastroenterology because you can give someone an ulcer. The next question they asked was, do strokes cause cognitive impairment? And the answer was absolutely not. And now we've come full course from that to saying, yes, stroke can give you cognitive impairment. We have vascular dementia. I showed you slides of leukoariosis. And now we've gotten to the point that we're even going to do cognitive evaluations in the acute stage while the patient's on the floor. So at least that's come to the forefront, that it is a common complication. For comorbidities, there's the Charlson Index. There's a great website called strokeengine.something. You guys familiar with it?
Not California, we heard at the international. Yeah. We heard it was called strokeengine.California.
Well, you should advertise more. They suggest that Shadok McMaster evaluation for shoulder pain. And unfortunately, a lot of these things are by process. And we've been left up. I did a survey of the Jewish St. Mary's, the Vic, the Neuro, on what evaluations would be done with stroke patients. And I had to present it to my committee. And I had to present like three slides because everyone was doing something completely different. And so we're trying to standardize what should be done. And then they have the GRIMS battery of general physical and mental abilities are some of the things that we're suggesting. And these are just for you guys to know where we're heading. There's lots of other things. Spasticity is an interest of mine, and not very many people evaluate it. But really, these are all the investigations we're suggesting, which I'm not going to go through in the interest of time here. So the Croak Stroke Strategy Rehab Plan. Well, we decided that individuals with moderate stroke who have AlphaFIM between 60 and 79 should spend 5 to 7 days on the stroke unit, followed by 6 to 8 weeks in rehab, and that's the rehab acronym. Severe strokes would be 41 to 59, 1 to 3 weeks, followed by 10 to 12 weeks in rehab. And very severe, less than 40, should be given 22 to 24 weeks to see what happens. In the U.S., they have something called SNF units, which are intermediate care units that are less than 3 hours of rehab a day that people can do, which are good, but they're very costly. And the question is, how do we get people home? Because when people go to rehab and they fail rehab, they come back to the hospital and occupy a hospital bed. And the question is, where can we send these people? What can we do for them? But when do they recover? So a person with a FIM of 60, the same as a person with a FIM of AlphaFIM of 42, and should they be given the same amount of time? Are they going to recover at the same rapidity? Rate? Do they need more time to attain their functional goal or not? Those are one of the harder things. Mark Bailey, who's a physiatrist in Ontario, is doing a great job correlating the people's AlphaFIM scores as well as their rehab success rates in terms of being able to return home. So that's just to give you an idea of what's to come. To get discharged from your rehab center is you have to have an outcome of greater than 90, judged to be secure to go home, that the home environment will enable the patient to continue rehab. Outpatient services will be available. Patients have plateaued for a good 2 weeks and not gotten better. An extremely severe case, you should be given a minimum of 4 to 6 weeks in rehab to allow for proper evaluation. So it's kind of a shame to use a rehab bed, but the question is to give people enough time to show what they can do and not give up on them. The other big thing that's been going around is the concept of early supported discharge. This is just a meta-analysis of all the trials showing benefit to that, and that's one of the other things that we're trying to do is get people out of hospital early, but make sure that their rehab facilities are there. I also sit on the best practice recommendations. We're actually rewriting this stuff and going through the literature in terms of its benefit, but the definition of early supported discharge is very different in these different trials as to what services are made available to them and how timely they actually get it. In principle, it's a great idea. It's really in practice can they be implemented in our society. The other thing we're trying to do are primary and secondary stroke prevention centers. So once you have a stroke, you have a place that you can always follow up in order to make sure all your risk factors are treated. On the Canadian Best Practices website now, there's something called the post-stroke checklist that I was involved in on 11 questions that should always be asked to your patient, asked to your patients, be it OT people, anybody in the stroke-related field, to see if any other services are warranted for these people. So the concept is to have nurses, pharmacists, physicians, and healthcare professionals, and these are like lifestyle nurses who can get you to stop smoking and help you exercise. You should be able to do FIMS and MOPEs and measure pain, depression, and fatigue scales, and also a 10-meter walk to try to establish what their baseline function is and make sure they're maintaining it. And the goal really is lifestyle management, but most important, to ensure social integration. The concept these places are also from a physician perspective, that if somebody has a stroke, that you can go to the emergency room, but we should also have these stroke centers where people can get their investigations done immediately. Patients that are at home and have deteriorated have an avenue to get a rapid evaluation and be reintroduced into services to make sure they don't lose ground they gained. Why do we have primary and secondary stroke centers? Well, this is an article from 2011. If you were seen in a specialized primary secondary stroke prevention center, you did better. You had a better chance of surviving long-term. There's a need for long-term management of these people, which gets forgotten by many of my colleagues. But it's clear that people, not only in the acute setting, but in terms of long-term management, that you're going to improve survival of your patients. So this is, I think, my last slide. And this is really what we've proposed to the ministry on how things should work. So if you have your TIA or stroke, you can go to the emergency room, or you can be triaged to a secondary prevention center to get all your investigations done, or you can be admitted. You can have inpatient and outpatient rehab services. We also have the global center. So the idea is to have community rehab centers and well of the tertiary rehab center where more of the acute patients are seen. We also want to have these little boxes here of community organizations that do many aspects of rehab, either reintegration at home, community organization of supportive services, and something that's going to really help with social reintegration. And then we want to have something that's going to sort of maintain your services long-term, and if you have a problem, you can come into this, or you can come into your stroke center, and what's said here in fine print is that you can be reintegrated in any of the necessary rehab services that you need. So the biggest problem I have is one of my patients is losing ground, is developing spasticity, and I'll inject them with Botox and give them an orthotic for their foot to walk. They need some more PT and some more rehab, but I can't get them back into the service. So the idea is to have access through the primary and secondary prevention clinics or through the rehabilitation long-term services or surveillance to be able to easily facilitate integration of these people back into the system when they need it, and at least have someone there to evaluate for your needs. It's estimated that 20% of individuals up to 10 years after their stroke require additional interventions that get ignored. And when I look at my colleagues as stroke doctors, they think they just need to see them maybe one time after their stroke, and that's it, that's all. When I talk to the GPs, they go, well, we're family doctors. We don't know what we're supposed to be evaluating here. You know, we're not neurologists. I don't know if they're better or for worse. I have no means of measuring this patient's outcome. I'm not an occupational therapist or a physiotherapist. I don't really know if they're doing better or not. I'm not a psychologist. I can't really tell if they're depressed or not. Unfortunately, in the field of stroke, the long-term management of these people, the buck's been passed around with nobody really assuming primary responsibility. And these people don't know where to turn because us as a medical community hasn't organized ourselves well enough to teach the residents and the family doctors and the neurologists what we do. So the concept of these maintaining rehab services or evaluate them is really to contribute to that 20% of people that requires ongoing care in order to facilitate their lives long term. And oops, I have it twice. Anyways, the key points are knowledge transfer, is the catch term for education these days. So I hope I filled you up with a lot of healthy stuff. But if you have any questions, I'm more than happy to address it. And I hope this was a good overview on the aspects of stroke I was supposed to talk on. Absolutely. So the treatment for hemorrhagic strokes are minimal to none. So they're really supportive therapies. There was a trial looking at a blood clotting factor to see if someone's bleeding in their brain, if you give them this blood clotting factor, could it make them better? And while it probably stopped the bleeding, by the time you actually get to the hospital, you've bled. And if you're not dead by then, you have this big blood clot in the brain and it doesn't really help. So there's a trial going on now called the MISTI trial, which is being done by a guy named Dan Hanley at Johns Hopkins. And what they're doing is you do your CT scan of the brain, then they find out where the blood clot is, and if you're within 4 hours, and again, it's a very short time window, they make a little hole in your skull, and they put this little scope down. It's like a straw, and they put it down so they're right into the blood clot. And then they put some TPA, so this doesn't make sense, but they're pouring TPA to break up the blood clot that's just formed, and then they're sucking it out with water, just irrigating it with water. So you usually die from a bleed in your brain because the new mass that's occurred, your skull is hard. There's nowhere for this. So you compress something or we use the term herniation, there's too much pressure there and you die from the increased pressure in the brain. The concept is to suck out the blood clot that make it less likely that you're going to have some terrible mass effect from this blood clot. Other than that, there's no other treatment for intracerebral hemorrhage. We'll put people on ventilators to help them breathe. We'll wait for the blood to resorb, which can take months. And sometimes we put a shunt in their brain to measure the pressure and try to control the pressure. But there is no study out there that shows that we have any treatment that really improves outcome in intracerebral hemorrhage. So it's kind of sad. It's really primary prevention. That's one reason why you should always control your blood pressure. If you have amyloid, there's nothing to do. If you have a vascular malformation, we can remove the vascular malformation, but you would have already bled. So unfortunately, we don't have any good treatments for that. Should be transferred to a stroke unit. The worst place in the world to have a stroke is in the hospital. So, you know, the guidelines suggest that if you have a stroke, by the time you hit the emergency room, that you should have your CT scan and start the medicine within 45 minutes. If you have your stroke in a general hospital bed, so I was at St. Mary's 3 weeks ago and somebody had a stroke on the 8th floor, and it took an hour to get them down to CT scan. And then they're like, well, we can't give TPA on the floor. They have to go to the emergency room. But you can't transfer someone from an inpatient to the emergency room. And then there's no beds in the ICU. It's very hard in the hospital. It's one of the worst things. But your question is, what should happen to a person who's there with pneumonia and has a stroke? They should be transferred to a stroke unit. They will do much better in a stroke unit based on the literature. And that's one of the criticisms of the new hospital being built, is that if you have a stroke, if you have pneumonia, then you're going to be at the new hospital, I guess. And then if you fall and break your leg, they're going to send you back to the general because there's no orthopedics there. And then once the leg is surgerized, they'll send you back to the new hospital. But then if you have a stroke there, they're going to send you to the general because there's no stroke unit at the new hospital. So it's a big, good question on how to integrate services in our healthcare system. But I think the take-home message is that people that are admitted to a stroke unit where all the people that is stroke, by people who are trained and educated continuously in stroke, by stroke professionals, stroke neurologists, stroke OTs, I don't know if they exist, but that's what's best for the patient, and that's what I want when I have my stroke, hopefully, in a long time from now. Yes? Yeah, so, well, first of all, there's telemedicine, but that's, so if there's telemedicine and there's tele-rehab, I've never heard of tele-OT or tele-PT consults. I guess they're all are feasible. I think the best stroke center in Canada is Calgary. I don't know which.
They won the award, yeah. Toronto just came in
now.
They awarded. Do you want to explain a little bit, maybe, about the benchmarks of Canadian stroke strategy?
No, because I don't know them. No, you can tell us.
Oh,
I don't
so
know.
Yeah,
is in the lower tier, is the proper terminology.
Yes, well, you're right. The bottom of the barrel is my terminology, and you do. I'm like really old, so I can say stuff like that. He still needs to be politically wise.
Not for long.
So that was the whole, we are benchmarking.
But I think, I mean, just to defend, I mean, I think there are some things we do very well here. And I think one of the shortcomings in Calgary, for example, the long-term stroke management of their patients. And so they see their patients once afterwards and that's it. And this whole concept of long-term care is really not there. And I think it's interesting because stroke used to be just give the person an aspirin and walk away. And we've come miles in the last 15 years. But But I still think there's a lot of responsibility still on the spectrum of the disease to make sure it's handled. And I think it's all of our responsibilities to do that. And so the Canadian best practice recommendations, there's been no great evidence for long-term management of these stroke patients, so it's been neglected, but it's another important aspect of it. And I think particularly at the general, we have a very good stroke prevention clinic where we follow our people long-term. It's just one aspect of the puzzle. The rest of it we need to improve on, unfortunately. Any other complaints? Yes. So no, that's a good question. So, on east of St. Lawrence Boulevard, the SHRM has done a great job making Notre Dame the designated stroke center for acute strokes, and that's worked very well. It was part of a pilot project with Urgence Santé, so it's sort of just kept on going, and they're doing a very good job. In Quebec City, they have good organization with Enfant Jésus being the designated stroke center. I think the problem we have in Montreal is that we just have so many hospitals. And the urban planning was not ideal. One reason why Calgary is such a good center is because it's a new city. They only had one hospital, so you didn't really have any choices where you're going to bring them. And they've done a good job organizing it with the community hospitals in the area to really fast-track patients into Foothills Hospital when they need it. I have no idea. Sherbrooke is the only hospital in the area. And it's a time constraint of getting you from these smaller towns and the eastern townships in. And I don't know what's going on in Hull, but we have a big province and with things very spread out, which is not a great thing in terms of organizing care. And our biggest detriment is that we sort of have too many hospitals too close to each other in Montreal, which creates some political conflict, but also sort of divides up services, unfortunately. But I think the best acute stroke care hospital is actually Notre Dame Hospital. The way they're integrated with the Urgence Santé right now is ideal.
In terms of access to services after having a stroke, you're talking about not having patients not being able to access what you can use, and so ideally, in this model, they would be able to go to like the secondary prevention.
Yeah. Yes, I don't know if one of the terms in Quebec now is in guichet unique, was the like just a specific place that could have. Like what I suggested is that there should be a 1-800 number. If anybody with a stroke who thinks they're getting worse or is having any problems should be able to call and get guided. And in here, there's going to be sort of like an evaluation center that patients can have easy access to if you're outside of the major cities. In the cities, it'll be the primary and secondary stroke prevention centers where these people are supposed to be followed long term, anyways, that they'll have avenues to get back into the system. I mean, the problem is when people come to see me, like I have no idea where I'm supposed to call. And to call for outpatient services these days is a little bit difficult to get done. Training in stroke and they're sent to the emergency room all the time. Mm-hmm. And the CLSCs are the same. It's go to the hospital. There's no corridor. There's no corridor. There's no stroke training place for these people to do. They handle whatever call. And then there's no corridor once you're evaluated on how do you get back into the system. Yeah. Like even if you come see me at the Montreal General, and I was like, oh, this person needs more rehab. This needs more OT evaluation. That's great, but like, where am I supposed to get it? The OTs in the hospital say, you know, it's not an inpatient, and it's not ours, and they live here, and we don't know. There's no organized care. There's no corridor. There's no pathway. And what we want to do is facilitate patient care when needed. Yeah, so I told you my interest is spasticity, and one of the treatments for spasticity is injecting Botox. So in the last two trials we've had, looking at people who've never received Botox, do you know what the average time for them to get their first injection of Botox and getting the spasticity identified is? So from the time they had their stroke till I enrolled them in the trial or just treated them for their spasticity was 5.5 years. Yeah. And what's interesting is I was talking to Nicole because our paper just got rejected from the journal this morning. is that it was a multinational study. One of the things was that when they looked at Germany and Sweden and the UK, it was the same time delay. 4 to 5 years later, people are getting their therapy for the first time. And people don't know about it, people still don't know what to look for. And one of the things I like about this post-stroke checklist that's come out, finally gives some framework of what you should be following the patients for. And the concept is to try to provide corridors or pathways for people to get back into the system. Because it's very hard. I hate all these folks on day and all these different numbers because they send everybody to, I'm in the emergency room, I see what happens. It's like, oh, my pinky's tingled. Well, why do you have a string tied around it? Oh, yeah, I forgot. I was supposed to remember something, and they have no secret. It's just like the things people come in with are amazing. And, it's hard. You have to realize you have a nurse, and I'm not berating nurses. You have somebody over the phone who can't see a patient, who's not a physician, which I'm not saying is going to be any better or worse, making a decision on someone's health. So, everyone who has chest pain, hi, I have chest pain. Should I go to the emergency room? Sure. Hi, why are you here? Oh, I have chest pain. Well, what happened? Well, I ate 3 burritos with extra hot sauce, and I just started to burn a lot afterwards. It's really, telemedicine is hard. Maybe if we get a video with that, it would be a lot easier. Maybe if everybody Skyped Afosante, it would be a little bit better. But it's really hard to make these decisions. And even for us, we don't know what to do with the people once we get them. So people come to me, it's like, oh, I saw Dr. Mean, I have this problem, you identified it. It's like, yeah, but I don't know how to get you back into rehab now. Like, I don't know who to call. Like, you have to admit you sometimes to get you back into rehab, which is a complete waste of resources. So this system is to bypass it. And the concept is, is that anybody here, can reintegrate or re-refer people in for evaluation. That's just supposed to happen in a timely manner. And that people aren't lost. Because even I'm involved, I still don't know. I've been here 12 years. I have no idea how to get my patients back into rehab. And everybody's telling me it's so easy, but it doesn't work.
Thank you very much for today.
Thank you.
Water good in the bathroom? On that one.
There's no water fountain, but I think, it will kill you to drink it once.
Okay.
You drink it all the time, only
okay.
Because the pipes rolled and rusted.
Okay. I'll go to Hosmer.
No, I'll have a drink. I gave him, he survived.
Okay.
That was from.
Thank you.
one person. I mean, I just got.
Thank you.
going to give you my phone number. Email me anytime, but I'll also give you my phone number because sometimes you just need to talk to the prof. And I don't often sit here, so I don't want you to say, oh, she doesn't have office hours, because no, I do not have office hours. 514-624-1345. Yeah, but people almost never go look at it, and then they go, I couldn't reach you. So I'm making a point of, yes, I'm reachable, and feel free to do that. The only thing I ask is not after 9:30 at night, because I'll answer your questions until 10, and then I'll want to kind of figure out into work mode. So please feel free, because sometimes something comes up, you just want to talk through something, or you're doing an assignment, and you're stuck, and two of you are saying two opposing things, wasting a lot of words, but no, that's not what she said, and yes, that's what she said. Basically, this is the last course I'll be teaching at McGill. I'm retiring, which is why I do need to apologize that you've gotten all this mishmash of it's a totally modular with a one-week intensive. Now, I had decided that in December, and I had revamped the course accordingly, and I thought you would all receive that. In all fairness to everyone here, as you know, Judith Soitcher left on a medical emergency leave, and other things came up, so I guess I was under the assumption when I left to go away that all was in order. So, number one, my apologies to you. Number two, we will be taking these, so for when the days you don't want to come or you know you don't feel you can because of your schedule, they'll be taped. Today I tried to get it taped, but we realized again that Maria had blocked the taping in this room, like the access and the details you don't need to know. So she has now unblocked it, and I spent all morning with ICC, but it's just too late. So I couldn't, it was ready 4 minutes before Dr. Lee started, but I couldn't bounce him off to start plugging it in. So next time it will be. Did you enjoy his lecture?
Yeah.
I thought it was fabulous. I think we're very, very lucky to have him. And it really was a reciprocal gift. I had done a couple of things for him, and so I said, would you please come and talk to him? And I thought it was a really excellent lecture. But like I said, I love stroke, so it could just be that I was interested. Let's have fun together. Let's not make this a stressful thing. You are the first cohort ever to have this course. We need it. I think Ted today did a nice job of situating why we need it. And you could see that we're all human beings, just like everyone else. We're a small group in Canada that work in stroke. We're really a small group. And we're all burning the candle at both ends to try to make stroke better. We're not this obscure group of people. We're you. You will be, if you take this course and finish and move into stroke clinically, you will be the catalyst for change, for better treatment. And so, to me, I think this course is incredibly important, and I think all of you taking it, it's more important to me that you're left with a passion for stroke than, I don't understand assignment three and blah, blah, blah. Because honestly, like, I'm not very engaged in worrying about that. I noticed from the questions that were asked today that you guys are engaged and you're bright and sharp. That for me was a great pleasure to hear. So we'll talk about the assignments. Some of them will be online, like we promised. I'll keep with the format because it's a variety, and I like that. So you will be quizzed in a variety of ways. But honestly, I really don't care about mark one mark here and oh, you only got a half a mark. It's just I can't be engaged at that level. I know you need good marks. I understand scholarships. I understand all the issues of. But I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, okay? So I will always try to do what's fair. You can always tell me I don't feel that's fair. We'll talk about it. We'll come to an agreement. But let's not put a lot of effort there. Is that okay with everybody? So, because as I was thinking about what I'd love to see happen, I really want you to be engaged in learning. And all this quiz stuff is bugging me because it's lacking in learning sometimes. It puts you in a box. So
Dr. Wayne started telling you a little bit, and I guess you could get the sense that there are big changes coming down in Montreal and in Quebec in terms of stroke. I think for me, the biggest thing is that when I started here at McGill in 1971. It's a long time ago. I became a clinician. I was director at the Richardson of OT. I didn't know much about stroke. I knew what I had learned in these walls. And I just loved, I know that sounds weird, treating people with stroke. I found that it pulled on every ounce of creativity, knowledge, neuro, everything I could think of, figuring out how to. And what I really liked is people with stroke generally, if you're a smart clinician, and I don't mean IQ smart, they will get better. And they will join you on the journey. And so if you use everything about yourself, they move along with you well. And I mean, I always used to say it's really funny because I'd get a new student in, you know, and they would shadow me, let's say if they were in first year. And at the end of the day, I knew they thought I was crazy. Because with some patients, you know, and I don't want to stereotypically model people, but, you know, you get the frail little lady, she's had a stroke, her arm is dangling, she's paralyzed, she's already quite frail going into this whole episode. And you use a gentle approach. You know, Mrs. So-and-so, how's it going today? Could we try three times? Could we get your, could we work together? You know? And then you've got these old, you know, I used to have the Italian bruisers, you know, and with them I was like, get your you-know-what out of that chair. And I think to myself, oh my God, I'm sure these students have not learned any of this, like, skills training in terms of. And so I think that's why I love stroke, was because it was a field that had huge gaps. We didn't know what to do, but I could see such potential and a patient that was going to improve if you did the right thing. Since that time, what to me is amazing, even as I sit and listen to Dr. Wayne present it, and even if I know it in my heart, the data now shows that when patients are treated, and you could see the doctors, they're still shocked. And they say, oh, we have to break down why it is that a stroke unit works. We have to come out with a few, what is it that's making, because a physician is trained that a physician does. And they still can't believe that you could reduce mortality and change morbidity by 30% when you have OTs and PTs and speech language on the site. It still shocks them. And what we see is that when you have a strong interdisciplinary team, and I have a theory behind it after years, that it's not scientific in nature, my theory, but what happens is, and along this course I'll show you some of the slides, what happens is we all screw up. In our daily practice, nobody wants to, but we all do. And so what I think happens on a stroke unit that you can't measure is you become a cohesive one around the patient. And so if I forget one morning that Mrs. So-and-so came in last night and, you know, nobody quite checked whether she has dysphagia, and this morning dietary put, you know, some solids on her bed tray, it doesn't matter. Because someone else in that team, if it's not the OT, it'll be the speech language, or it'll be the other nurse. Someone in that team, we're all working with this great knowledge of six or seven things that have to happen or we're going to kill the patient. Now, compared to 1976 at the Richardson, I didn't have a speech language pathologist on my team yet. I had someone come in 2 days a week afterward. And I didn't really know much about dysphagia. We weren't trained. We hadn't been taught. There was very little about dysphagia. The only thing I knew about my patients with stroke is I thought they were doing so darn well. And then often they would be back at the acute care hospital with pneumonia. And I couldn't understand it. I really couldn't. Understand why did Mrs. So-and-so get pneumonia? She didn't seem to have a bad cold. And only later, when I came back here and started to take advanced courses and started to read more, did I realize that what I was missing in 1970 was that these people were getting aspiration pneumonia because I was doing feeding. And I was really messing up. Not intentionally, but really messing up. So just to tell you, you the whole cycle of where things came from. So now this lecture is fun, I hope, and we're going to take it through for an hour. That's the wrong time on the clock. And as some of the things that you already heard, I'll go through very, very quickly. So Dr. Wien already spoke to you that for the 34 million people we have here in Canada, we're running 50,000 strokes that we see, but there is a lot more than that. Okay, so the ratio is suggesting 1 in 9. So one of the things I really find important is that you become ambassadors. Canadian Stroke Network and their website has fridge magnets. I always make sure that I handed those out to family and friends. They should have them on their fridges. And we'll talk about that. And also, like I said, just a silly little thing, like someone saying, I think my mom just had a stroke. Because as soon as you work in rehab, people will start to say, I think my mom might. But there is no one in Canada that will not be touched by stroke. Every single one of you will know a friend, a family member who will have a stroke. That is for sure. And the difference is just knowing some certain things about what does it look like when someone has a stroke and what are the actions we should take. And like I said, our healthcare system is still not in place in the ER. They still do not. There are some places where you will get proper management, and it makes the world a difference. It makes the difference between someone going home the next day with absolutely nothing left in terms of motor paralysis, etc., or basically spending the rest of their lives with severe motor paralysis, etc. So those are things just for us. It's great to know, and some key lines that we should always keep in our brains. And we've got a lot of people, a lot of my early research, I was interested in community, and I did my postdoc in community and cost effectiveness of stuff related to not only stroke, but primarily these 300,000 people. Do you know how many people have a stroke every year in the U.S. in our friendly, attached territory? 700,000? Yeah, and we've got millions and millions of people with living, millions. So it's shocking. And this is, he'd already told you a little bit about this, but I wanted to bring up a point. When you look at those who die, when you take that out of the equation, because this stuff adds up to 100%, we have 50 to 60% of people who have a mild stroke. And they come up to the Royal Vic or the M&I or the MGH, and they are discharged right away. So they're either they leave the immersion, they never get a bed. And we've done some studies, and one of the people who's going to come talk to you is Annie Hochette. And Annie was my postdoc and then went on. She's now a University of Montreal professor. And she'll talk to you about what people tell us after they've had a mild stroke and what they receive as services. And it's not much. So this is the vision of the Canadian Stroke Network. Have you all heard of the Canadian Stroke Network? You're saying yes, but I'm not sure. Others? How many people have heard of it? A quick show of hands, very few. Yeah. So Canada has a funding for something called Networks of Centers of Excellence. And there are huge fundings to do something big. So if you wanted to change cardiac care or you wanted to change diabetes in Canada, you would apply for one of these big NCEs. I was not part of the original application for this, but this became, for over a decade, the Canadian Stroke Network. And what it does is it funds researchers and clinicians to change stroke care in Canada. And it's just coming to its end, because one of the rules of NCEs is you can have 3 rotations and then you're out. You don't get to get any more money. So as we come up now in 2013, we are going to be wiped out. And that's why it was so important that hospitals and provinces take on the initiative for themselves, because this funding agency will no longer be there. And Heart and Stroke, which you've heard of, Heart and Stroke Foundation of Canada, will take on some of the activities that were done. I was, for 10 years, the head for Canada of rehab and recovery. That was my role in the Canadian Stroke Network. charge on the Canadian level of changing rehab in Canada. And one of the major pushes we did is to start creating courses, because you can talk about advanced expertise, but if there's nowhere to train people, how are you going to have advanced expertise? And it's conflict. Tony Hakim is our scientific director, and I thought today it would be fun for you just to learn some of the myths about how, when we graduated, Tony is in Ottawa, but he graduated from here at McGill. So this is what they were told. When you graduated stroke neurology in those days, there was nothing that you could do to prevent a stroke, is what we were taught. Like, it just happens, it's bad luck. Can you imagine nowadays thinking, oh, poor you, bad luck? And that once somebody had the stroke, they were brought into ER by the family or an ambulance, and they were left, you know those corridors in the ER? You put those people in the corridor, and you watch the stroke unfold, because there's not much you can do for a stroke. It was interesting. Who posed the question today about hemorrhagic stroke? It was you. I don't know your name, sorry.
Farwa.
Farwa?
Yes.
And so you could see that Dr. Wing was more or less saying, we don't really have great active interventions yet for hemorrhagic stroke. And so that's what it was not that long ago for all. Okay? So that, you've got to put yourself in that situation, though, to think about it. To think that not that long ago people were told, oh, strokes are just bad luck, like an aneurysm, you're born with it, it blows, what can you do, you know? And once it happens, we're just going to wait for it to unfold, and then we'll call the OTs and PTs, speech language, and try to help whatever's left. And that's how I started my training, all right? Whatever was left, we'll try to work with. Obviously now, we look at it from a little bit of a different point of view. So, let's see, can we get this to work a little bit? So, usually we're in here. We're kind of stuck in that box. And some of us in rehab work in here. We work in acute care, but we say words like, well, you know, they go out of acute care so fast, there's nothing really much I can do as an OT or PT except evaluate or triage quickly to, you know, whatever. And then we were all happy, really happy working in here, because we would get like 70 days to know the patient, to work with them, to watch them improve. It was a fun time, because you got this long window. You really felt that you could do something. It was, you know, the family got to know you, and they brought you chocolates, and you tried to refuse, but they insisted. And it was a really nice time in rehab. I enjoyed it. And then, of course, community reintegration, we talk the talk and walk the walk, but we all know what our CLSCs look like. And so, back to this, which is now shorter and tighter. This, which by the time you go find the patient in their bed, you can't find them because they're out and been discharged. So one of the things I think we need to do is we need to, as rehab professionals, get involved in here. And that's what I want to talk to you a little bit about today. So just talking a little bit about, as Dr. Wien pointed out, I was going to talk to you. One of the things you'll see overall is, take a look at this. And then tell me what you see. This is age standardized mortality for our population in Canada. And this is for stroke. So what are you seeing in terms of stroke? Are we going down? So overall, stroke is going down. However, what else is happening in our world here in Canada? And he talked to you about who is more likely to have a stroke. Increasing heart disease, increasing hypertension. What else?
Diabetes.
And old age. Okay. So one of the things that happened is we saw this coming down. One of the things we want to do is congratulate ourselves. But in another way, we know that that's not going to stay like that for very long, and that we're going to have some serious things to do. One of the nice things is things like smoking are coming down. rate of smokers in our country. So we've got to get that down. Take a look at this. So this is a slide, men and women. But what's really interesting about this slide is people with high blood pressure who were aware they had high blood pressure and still not treated. And the thought that we still have people who don't want to be treated for high blood pressure when they're going to blow a gasket is really interesting. But you can see we're doing a much better job. So some of the advertising, some of the pushing is helping. So here's our population, and if you look at the black chunks, in 2006, look, this is how much, for you to read this slide, this is how much we had of a population that was 90 plus years of age. And in 2006, so 30-odd years later, 35 years later, this is what we have. So you can see that where we're going to fill now, this whole black, is with a much older population. And that's what we're really worrying about in stroke. Because if we keep the same pattern, yeah, it was great, stroke was going down, but all these people are going to become at risk for stroke. And so that's why you're going to be so busy treating people with stroke. Not only do we hope with this new Quebec, that goes through the new Quebec model of stroke, is going to be a sophisticated treatment by rehab professionals like you who will have certification. By taking this course, it will increase your likelihood of getting a job on one of those stroke units because you'll be the first ever with some extra expertise in stroke. And it's to treat these people who we think will live longer and then have their strokes later. So take a look at this one. This is a percentage of the population with high blood pressure. Is this shocking to you? Take a look at this. Take a look at the percentage of people. This is 50%, okay? Take a look at the numbers of people. How many people still use salt? How many people have a salt shaker in their home? True confessions. You, right? Because you came back with a rebuttal. That was cute. I like that. But really, you didn't ask the right question, Nicole. Okay, let's ask it again. How many people have a salt shaker? Right hand up. Because I do too. Left, right hand. And the left hand, if you use it every day or so. So for those of you who are using salt or soya sauce or however else you hide yourself, if it's not in your shaker, we estimate now, and Kevin Willis from the Canadian Stroke Network will be on, I think, Marketplace or whatever.
I was on the other day.
Was he on, Kevin?
It was a really good episode, actually. But even people who try to cut out aren't really reading what they're eating.
Exactly.
And so you are all guilty.
So you saw Kevin? He's a skinny. You saw Kevin? He's a skinny guy.
Well, it was Marketplace, and it went on sodium.
Okay. So you, probably, yeah. Okay. I thought it was coming up. I was going to tell you about that. Okay.
Yeah.
I knew it was like just. Anyways, the bottom line is that we estimate that of the 50,000 strokes I showed you, we could eliminate 20,000 a year. If we threw out our salt shakers and threw out our canned salt food. So I'm just going to show you some more of that. But, I mean, think about it. Who's interested in this? Like, the pharmaceutical companies love this. One in every two people are on high blood pressure meds. One in every two. Like, if you had a product you could sell to one out of every two people in a demographic, that would be like creating one brand of cell phone and just owning the whole market. That would be amazing. So we got to change that because we're going to have to, you and I are going to have to treat all these patients. And take a look at this. This is really interesting because we've all heard about this, and this is the obesity issue. So this is the percentage of the population, 18 plus, who were obese, and there was two, you'll see two bars here. One is actually measured, so someone measures you, and the other is I report that I'm obese. And so if you take a look at this, where we're going, this is where we're going. Amazing, isn't that? So that's amazing to me. Because we've gone from, you know, this is not that long ago, and we're just going up and up. So we're running, and obesity, from what they're saying, is starting at age 5. So what we're doing is we're feeding people. There are children that eat french fries 5 times a week. There's a huge percentage that are eating french fries 5 times a week. And the number one, I don't know, did anyone see the mayor of New York last night on TV? The mayor of New York is trying to eliminate supersized soft drinks. And there's a whole legislation and they're fighting and whatever. Well, that's not what's so important. What's so important is you say, what right does a mayor have to control my supersized soft drink? But then you think to yourself, the number one association with childhood obesity now is drinking a soft drink a day. So for people who drink a soft drink a day. And so the next argument in the research kind of brain was, well, I don't drink sweet drinks. I drink diet drinks. Mm-hmm. And so now they've done the research that shows seems not to matter. So I found it so interesting last night watching this that now New York City is trying to regulate the size of the soft drink that's sold to you. But really, if you think about it, we're creating illness by not doing anything. So there you go. There's the supersize. So we're supersizing everything. And this is the public awareness campaign in Ottawa that we initiated from the Canadian Stroke Network. Because remember, let me give you a little situation to this. We all went into the Canadian Stroke Network, scientists, clinicians, researchers, with a very, very specific mandate. So the lab people all wanted to find a new way to regenerate the brain or how TPA was working. The rehab people all wanted to find the best treatments so that, you know, we all the animal scientists would stand up because each one of us would have to present. There were 4 axes, present at the annual report where we've gone in stroke in Canada. And my colleague would always stand up and go, my goal is to wipe out Nicole and her whole rehab and recovery because if we get TPA and everything in line, we won't need them, you know. And then I would stand up and say, knock yourself out, I'd be happy to find other work. You know, that would be we would do that every year as a comedy act. But over the time, we realized that all of us were putting a lot of work in, but if we really wanted to impact on Canada and Canadians, then the best way we could impact was to move down what I call down the funnel to stopping the stroke. So no, I don't want to be an OT with lots of work in stroke. Does anyone here want to have lots of work because we have a lot of people who have strokes? No, we'll find other work. Well, I'm sure we'll all find other work. So that's where we all got involved in these kind of things. And so it seemed like weird at the beginning because it wasn't what we originally set out to do. So we kept doing the other stuff, but we also did stuff like this, advertising on buses. And one of my favorite campaigns that we did was the annual salt licks, and we still do it. And I love this one. I think it was a brilliant idea by one of our people, Kevin Willis, who probably was on Marketplace the other night. And what we did is every year we would give an award for the worst salty, disgusting thing out on the market. And we would announce it broadly. And so the first year was shock people. You know those little baby food jars that are only this big? So this is what, we have these magnets. If you want them, just email Canadian Stroke Network and they'll send you a batch to put on your fridges and on your parents' fridges because they're probably eating salt out there, yin-yang. And we should be staying in here. Alright? So this is what, if you look at what we should be doing in terms of salt, this is a little tiny jar of baby food And listen, all of you are going to be mummies and daddies probably in the future, and you're probably all going to be busy health professionals. So the reality is you will not have a lot of time for that grow your own food and mush it in the whatever and make little ice cube baby food, because you'll do that for 4 to 6 weeks when the baby starts eating. Then you'll realize, like, your whole life's no good. You'll be yelling at your spouse because the reality of coming home after a work day and picking your veggies and creaming them into creamies and putting them in ice cubes is going to last a very short time, take it from me. So what we need to do is have baby food on the shelves that we can buy on days when we're stressed and work doesn't seem to take its own place. It's taking our personal life. And not have this, okay? And then the best salt liquids. Who's eaten Mr. Noodle, come on, as a solution to, like, I'm hungry and I need something and it's lunchtime and there's a microwave at... How many? Come on, true confessions. All right. So one Mr. Noodle has 2,640 milligrams of salt. Now let's go back and talk about what you should be having. All right. So this is what we do now as a way to start drawing attention. But just think about it. If one out of every two Canadians, by the time they hit an age where they'll still be alive 20 to 30 years, has to be on high blood pressure meds. And where there's whole societies that eat meat. I love going to international conferences because you hear from the other side of the world and it's totally different. There are whole societies that eat meat, but they eat game meat, that, you know, free range. And none of them have high blood pressure. There isn't a single person in that whole tribe, because they haven't been infiltrated by Mr. Noodle. And so it isn't eating meat that's going to, you know, I mean, not that we should eat meat, of course, but some of it's okay. So if you've ever watched, I don't know if you've ever seen, there's a Campbell's commercial that was on a couple of years ago, this guy in this huge room with salt.
Yeah.
And they were trying to show that they were going down in salt. Now, one of the things we have to realize as we go into professional practice, whatever you pick to do in your professional practice, is what we know is right to do and what we do are two different things. Yes? Yes, for us, for our patients. So the new soups have 480 milligrams. Is that okay? No, it's high. It's high. Okay. Address that with you. Thanks for bringing it up. Okay, I'm going to address that because that's really interesting what you're saying. So this is too high, but the reality is, has anyone ever eaten a Ritz cracker? How many people have eaten a Ritz cracker? Okay, so there are normal Ritz crackers that I grew up with. There are Ritz crackers that are low sodium. And there are Ritz crackers that are low in fat. You will not find a low-sodium, low-fat Ritz cracker. Do you know why? Because it's cardboard. So when you take away the salt and you take away the fat, it tastes like a piece of cardboard, or worse. So that is why we have to also recognize that there's no sense forcing companies, because one of the critiques of this is, why did the Heart and Stroke Foundation put a label onto things that are still not quite okay? But Heart and Stroke has argued that if you just try to make the whole population change their taste buds overnight, then people aren't going to buy the product, that product's going to go bankrupt, and that's not the way to get buy-in from companies. So the philosophy is, if they're coming down, we give them a reward for going in the right direction. Okay, so one of the things you were saying is that salt contents are different. So, do you know where the stroke belt is in the United States? There's something called the stroke belt.
Midwest.
Yeah, you're right. So areas, Midwest, and is New Orleans in Midwest?
Or South Midwest.
Yeah. So areas like New Orleans. So when you go there on a conference, I try to bring my own nuts and raisins in my pocket. Because when I'm there 5 days, I can barely eat at the end because they eat calories. catfish and deep fried whatever with salt. And so people there have strokes at rates that are incredibly different from the rest of the U.S., and that's why it's called the stroke belt. But what manufacturers have done, and I think it's important for us, because to tell you the truth, I was really naive about all of this going into this campaign. Even though I was part of it, and I was wearing a shirt saying Sodium 101 website in green, horrible green colors, I was really quite naive. And so what they do is, depending on where you live, your Kellogg's Corn Flakes, which I hope no one needs anymore, but it's like hardcore too, but your Kellogg's Corn Flakes will have different levels of salt depending on where you live. So they will test out a market, see your tolerance for reduced salt, and if they're going bankrupt in your community, they'll up the salt again. And that's why you're finding, depending on where someone lives, their Kellogg's Corn Flakes, their Campbell's Soup, their Mr. Noodle will have a different. So it's really interesting. So here's Tony again. So one of the things that we realized is, think about this, because it's very basic. It's a very common sense thing, but if you never think about it, you never go through the process. If I bring a parent to the hospital for a stroke, and I'm racing, they're all sweaty and nervous, and or I've called the ambulance, but everything's like racy, nervous, whatever, adrenaline pouring, and when they get there, they end up in the corridor with almost, you know, once in a while someone checking that they're progressing in their stroke. What has that left in my brain forever as a 75-year-old or whatever? What does that leave? Like, so this person has watched their parents, you know, 30 years ago go through this. What impression does that leave?
My father.
Yeah. It's not very urgent, right? Now, can you imagine a scenario in Canada where someone said, oh my God, I can barely breathe, I feel it. And you kind of say, oh, why don't you take a nap? Never, right? We have been trained in Canada to see chest pain, even if you did eat a double whatever, whatever, with onion rings, as something that you race to the hospital for. It is a heart. And that's why they've changed. We don't say, oh, I think you might be having a myocardial infarct. We call it a heart attack for a reason. Okay. So one of the flaws that we had, and I think Ted Wien brought it out, is we called it a cerebral vascular accident. Whoops. Well, there's nothing very urgent about that. Okay. And then we called it a stroke. Whoops. Again, no urgency. And so one of the things that we should be calling it is, I think it's a brain attack. Because if we could get the Canadian public to have the same thought as heart attack, I think it's a brain attack, then we would get people to hurry. So what I want to talk to you a little bit about now is, I've had a lot of fun going around the world, Australia, Melbourne, and Sydney, and to Glasgow, and watching how they do their campaigns to try to get the population aware of stroke. Because although we do a good job on heart, we haven't done such a good. So here are some surveys. And what we ask people, because again, you know, all of us were working either science lab people or me waiting for the person to have a stroke so I can do all my constraint-inducing robotics and all my new interventions on them. But really, the bottom line is if we don't get patients in quickly, when we can do something and a TPA is something suitable for them to treat them, then we're really not in the right area, right? Because first, let's get them in, let's get them treated early. So here's what people said they would do. You can read it. So we asked 1,500 people, so we did a huge survey, and they were greater than 35 years of age, so they should have heard about stroke by then, somebody, a grandparent, or somebody, you know, in their family, friends, somebody. And what did people say they would do if they experienced a warning sign? They would make a doctor's appointment. Or they would lie down and rest. That is the most typical. The most typical is when somebody's arm gets heavy and weird and they're dragging their foot, go lie down, take a rest, and see, maybe they'll wake up and it'll be gone. And sometimes it is gone because it's a transient ischemic attack, so the TIA is resolved. And 36 wouldn't take any emergency action, and Quebec was the worst. I like to think of Quebec as the best. I like to think of us as optimistic people that are fun-loving. So instead of saying we're the worst, I think we just like to, we like to laugh. I've gone all over the world lately, and I never see as much fun as if you go to a bar on a Friday and Saturday, French Canadians are just having a great time. So I think we don't want to worry about this stuff, so it's like, I don't feel so good, I'm going to sleep for a while. So here's what they did. Heart and Stroke decided that they would do a campaign. And they did the campaign, and they did public awareness of stroke, and they measured it before and after the campaign. So you can see where I put the heart and stroke sign was the campaign. Dr. Wien, Ted, yeah.
It's really confusing information. Because he said it's not a sign of stroke, and here it's written it's a sign of stroke.
Excellent, excellent. So remember I was saying to you I've had fun going to different countries and seeing what they use in terms of their campaign? So I'm going to show you that there are other campaigns. And I'm really glad you brought that up, because what happened was, when they had severe headache as one of the signs of stroke, the emergency departments, and I remember when this campaign were flooded. So everybody that got a bad stress headache, a migraine, was flooding emergency. Yeah. So this has changed now. So very good that you pointed it out. It's not there anymore. Oh, it might be on the website. But the FAST, I'll show you the next one, doesn't use it. And that's why I say different places use different ones. And it's all about, you've all taken measurements and you've all taken diagnostics, etc. You've all taken sensitivity and specificity. Mm-hmm. Yes? No? Yes, most of you have. Okay. So what you're saying about the headache, okay, is related to sensitivity and specificity. If I keep all these variables in, what percentage of people will hurry to the hospital that I can potentially treat with a life-saving TPA that will reduce their likelihood of being permanently disabled? Versus how many people will come in for nothing and just swamp me? So they keep it in. Now it says your worst ever headache, one like you've never had before. And that's how they qualify. So that we realize that just saying a bad headache, people get that headache. So now they try to say your worst ever, one that's not anything like before. And doing it that way. But what do you see here? Did it go up from pre to post? The awareness of, whoops, sorry, I didn't mean to hit that. The awareness, did it go up from 2003 to after the intervention? It did, for most things, not for this. But in 2011, when we looked at it again, what do we see? It goes back down to baseline. So one of the things we know is that we've done campaigns for, and think about it, because it's really important to think about it. Do we forget what a heart attack is? Like, do our parents forget what a heart attack is, and our grandparents forget? No, it's like in your brain forever. Like, got chest pain, even if it's on the wrong, just go. For stroke, for some reason, we do all of this complicated, if it's this or this or this, and then we don't do a campaign for a while, and then it goes back down to baseline. So we haven't given a message of brain attack so clearly. So different countries are trying different messages. So this, in our best practice guidelines, which I was part of the group that wrote the rehab best practices for 2010, we now say this, and this is probably the most important thing. Call 911 if you have any symptoms. people were trying to shove mom into the car and drive her in, or drive their dad in, and they were losing precious time. And I'll show you something fun that some countries have been doing. So that's the most important thing, is that we need the public to know, and we need them to call 911. So that once they're in the ambulance, and that's the whole system of stroke, we need ambulance drivers who have little triage checklists, who know what to do, who get everything organized, and I'll show you some really sophisticated one. Have you seen this commercial? Mm-hmm. Has anybody seen this? There's one with a group of men painting, mm-hmm. and it's kind of a doom-doom-doom commercial. So the reason that it's changed so much is that there is a new president of Heart and Stroke of Canada, and they realize that we're not impacting on people the way we should be. So they're trying some new campaigns. And I saw another one 2 nights ago that's a brand new campaign that says most Canadians will spend the last 10 years of life in a disabled state. And that's their new campaign to make people aware. If you don't feel like worrying about a heart attack and you don't feel like worrying about a stroke, worry about being really not in good shape for 10 years. So start watching your blood pressure. Start watching your diabetes risk. Start watching your obesity level. And that's why they're doing that. Now, here's our Australian group from down in beautiful Sydney, Australia. And this is what they do. They do all kinds of campaigns like this. They have the FAST campaign. If your face gets slurpy or your arm gets weird or your speech gets slurry, hurry up. Time is of the essence. So that's their campaign. And some of the countries are using it. So this is really just, these are the guidelines to say what we need to do is hurry people, and I think people need to learn to hurry. And what's sad to me is that we still have 50% of Quebecers that say, I would go lie down. And so I think the message is also that we're not aware of is people who have transient ischemic attacks, 20% of them will soon have a stroke. And again, these are people that go, oh, thank God, my arm was all numb and weird, and now it's better. I don't need to go see anybody. And so you guys are going to be front line out there, and we need to educate. We can't count on our 25 neurologists. They're tired, they're thin spread, and there's very few of them. One of our campaigns is to try to get med students interested in being neurologists, but we have very few in Canada. And so we have tens of thousands more OTs and PTs than we have neurologists. So you've really got to, you know, be the campaigners for this. And then again, as he was mentioning, we used to have a window of time 3 hours for TPA. Why is that so important? A lot of our people live very, very far away from an acute care hospital. So the minute you feel weird symptoms, you will likely not want to go to the hospital. You need a bully in your family to bully you to go. They will say things like, oh, it'll be fine, it's just a moment. And usually when you hear success stories where TPA was administered and the person walked out the next day, there was a bully in the family dragging them out, calling 911, saying, I don't care what you say, we're going to do this, I know this is the right thing to do. And that's what we have to train people. Or no matter how many wonderful drugs we create and how much we can change stroke, we won't change it because the population will not know what to do. And so that's really... So let's take a look at this one. I wanted you to have a real life vignette because this is what we see all the time. This is what we hear from our patients. So Mrs. Jones is 63. She has left arm numbness and tingling. And this is why I said to you, usually people try to use something they can think back to. And she thinks back to when her sister had this happen. And they live in a rural area up in Knowlton. She'd like to go to the local hospital. She knows it. She's comfy. They're nice there. And that's where she had her gallbladder surgery. She doesn't want to come into Montreal, so she wants to go up to Cowansville. And she really doesn't want to share a room in the big city. Stressful. Montreal General is like a circus. She wants to go to her nice local. What are her recommendations? Does it matter? So those are the different regions that we typically have. Like this is in 1997. We have local hospitals. That's where people usually go. They feel comfortable. They like it. we have district stroke units and regional stroke units, and as you can see, each one gets fancier and fancier with more technology, and it's like Dr. Wien was saying today, if your patient is going to need neurosurgery, you've got to move them to the fanciest, and if not, they can get treated at the others. And now this is old-fashioned because now a lot of sites have MRIs. And so a lot of what we're seeing is airlifting people from these little communities and wondering, is it worthwhile? And that's why 911 needs to be called, because the decision shouldn't be with the person going, oh, no, no, just let me go. And I can understand, having had some health events, and if any of you have had health events, that the first thing you want to do is not be more stressed than you already are. You want to be comfy, so if you know where the place is or there's a friendly nurse that you know, that's where you want to go. It's not working. And as you can see in Quebec, they're trying to change it. And so this is the big hospital triage goal now, is the right patient, the right place, at the right time. So when I started sitting through these talks, because I knew I was teaching you all, so I sat through many talks that I usually not sit through, just so that I could make sure I was aware in 2013 of the big picture. But one of the things that I started sitting through was the ambulance talks, thinking, oh my God, now I'm doing ambulance stuff? Give me a break. But you really realize that you could talk the talk, you could, you know all about stroke. Who's going to go pick up the patient? It's the ambulance driver, the medics. If they're not trained to go to the right place, do the right thing, all of your talk is useless. They will not get the patient to the right place at the right time. And so now in Quebec, what they're trying to do is this type of thing, where they actually have a checklist, and if the person has had a stroke or it looks like it, then they take them to a stroke site. So, you know, when Ted today said it's very political, all the changes in stroke that will occur here in Montreal, you can imagine how political it is, because some hospitals will lose their designation and they will no longer get anybody with stroke. And that's really insulting to some of our hospitals around here on the mountain. But you also have to see that all of this needs to be trained. So you need people out there who are willing, who are medics, etc., to be trained, to know how to do their checklist. And so you have to go way back before the person ever gets to emerge. And so it gets really confusing, and you get tired, and people give up, and then the system never comes into play. So right now we have a bunch of very tired people who have created this amazing plan for Quebec, and hopefully they'll have a little more energy to push it so that it'll actually happen. And our health minister, who's Réjean Hébert, has said that we could do this plan, there's not a penny that's going to go in of extra money. So the other piece is, we can do it, but there's no money. So this is Frank Silver, a colleague. And one of the things we know is that if we want to provide good quality care, most Canadians do not live in Toronto or Montreal. They live up here in some northern Ontario. One of you asked earlier about what's going to happen up north. And so this is Frank. And again, I think, you know, we do research on sexy stuff that looks like cool, and then you have to implement it in the real world. Well, Frank Silver is somebody who talks the talk and walks the walk, and he sits at home on a Sunday with the TV on trying to watch whatever sports he's interested in, and this will ring in his living room, and he's on with an MRI that's being sent to his living room to check if this patient is a suitable candidate for TPA. And so the bottom line is, the complexity of administering this type of thing, right, where you have people who trust you enough. Like, for example, one of the sites is North Bay, Ontario. So North Bay is sending Frank a patient's MRI and scans, and now Frank is going to read it and say, do the TPA. And I've received, because I run the stroke engine site, I've received emails from nurses, what do I know about administration of TPA, who say, I have a patient with this and this, and am I supposed to administer the TPA now? Or I'm like, hold, wait. And I send that off to one of my other neuro experts in Calgary, because that's a site that Michael Hill runs, and he'll answer the nurse. it's not easy to change practice. Now, Frank, do you know how close Ontario is to Manitoba? So if he sees somebody on telemedicine that's in Manitoba, because he works in Ontario, he won't get paid for that. So he's not only running his own ward and neuro, but he's also doing this. And so people will do this as part of a short-term, wow, this is cool and interesting, and all of you in OT and Pinky will do it as a part of a short, interesting plan or research. But to do this on a daily basis for life, where, you know, on Sunday you're the only neurologist covering for two provinces, and if you're, or if you're an eMERGE and your eMERGE gets busy, is a whole other thing. And so that's what we're facing right now. We did it. It was fun. They proved that it would work, that we could administer TPA without having the specialist up there. And now we have the reality of everyone's burning up. And so that's where we sit right now. So have we changed? Bye-bye. No worries. So have we changed anything in the last years where we're trying to improve stuff? Well, there's the rate of TPA for people who show up in time to get it. So, yes, we've changed our ability to have people that don't need as intensive rehab. Have we changed, I'm going to skip to this. That would help, yeah, you'll be kind of cold. Yeah.
It's a question about, I understand are very few neurologists, so why are emergency room doctors not trained to read the radiological?
I love it, okay. So here's another question. So the question is like, okay, there's not enough of us, can you do it, right? So this is a little bit of like OTAs and PTAs and hiring others and ER docs. And we keep holding Quebec Stroke Summits and inviting the ER docs and hoping they'll show up so that they'll become engaged in stroke. Stroke's not very popular with internists, with ER docs. So we need to make it sexy and popular and interesting and dynamic, and I'll show you some stuff they've done in Europe that has kind of made it wow.
You just need the order from the doctor to say a TPH needs to be administered. It doesn't necessarily have to be the neurologist to say it, because the nurse is the one who's going to administer it, correct?
Or the physician, depending on the training and
exactly.
Who's there and who's
available. But they need to be able to make a call.
But people, if you give TPA and you give it to the wrong person, they will bleed right there to death. So it's a big onus on someone who's never done it to take the responsibility
right.
to do it. And you're right. And so that's what the whole discussion is. If we only have X amount of people that are neurologists, that are trained, we have two choices. Train more neurologists. People go, well, we can't afford more neurologists. We're not hiring extra. Okay, good. Your hospital doesn't have enough neurologists. We're not sending any more to St. Mary's. So we're only sending to the general. How dare you? And this is, and when he says politics, what you just said, so we asked the ER docs, could you please come to some training? It'll take you X amount plus no. And so that's the difference between research and clinical implication of, and that's why I think his last slide was about the funnel, you know, from what we know to what we do is a little bit of a, so your questions are fabulous. But so have we improved CT scan? Yes. Have we improved stroke units? But you know what, this scares me. In 2010, we have strong evidence that when people aren't in a stroke unit getting treated by an interdisciplinary expert team, they die at greater numbers and they have poor outcomes, and we still only have 20% of people treated in stroke units. So again, we're pushing, but we need more people pushing. So this is the one I was telling you about. So I go to Glasgow, and here in Canada we're sitting talking to each other and our American colleagues, and we're all mumbling about people always show up too late and they can't get a TPA, and so we're putting so much effort listening to the stupid TPA stuff that, like, we're not getting our patients, and by the time they get to the hospital, whatever. So this is a wonderful Hamburg. This one's in Israel, but the one that started was in Hamburg, Germany. And what they do is they have a scan in a van. So they have this van parked outside. When somebody in their community, because Hamburg is a fairly controlled community, has what they think is a stroke because they have their checklist, right? They run and they grab them, and then they start taking bloods in the van, so all the bloods are ready, and they do the scan in the van, and then they send the scan in. So they've been able to save about an hour of time by being creative and by a bunch of volunteers buying them a van with an MRI machine in it. So it's cool. The reason I like this so much is I think it's fun to say, oh, this is impossible, it's not going to happen, rural Canada, we're never going to get enough. And people who pushed it. So Frank Silver saying, no, I'll put it in my living room at home. I don't want another person to have a severe stroke for the rest of their lives just because there's no one to read the stupid scan. I'll do it at home. And so he did it at home. And then someone there saying, oh my God, you know, I sit here like this because the whole team, on a good stroke team in ER, when they know someone's coming in, that the paramedics have called in that's had a stroke, they're all standing at alert because they have this window of time after which they cannot. Think about it. Put yourself in the shoes of watching somebody become totally paralyzed, lose all their speech, become severely disabled, potentially in a wheelchair for life, or you know that if they just get them there in time and they have all of the checklist, they could potentially go home tomorrow. It is a huge difference in what we do for them. So these are people who I'd love to see in different countries pushing the envelope, not accepting that, you know, all of you will at times be tired in your career, and all of you are going to say things like, we don't have time for that. You're all going to say it. I promise you, remember me when you say it, because I know you're all going to say it. And these are people who go beyond that to say, we don't have time, but we're going to figure out another way to do it, rather than just give up. They push the envelope, and so I just love the scan in the van that the people are running around with doing scans. All right. I think what we're going to do, I have a little assignment for you for next time. So because we only have 10 minutes, and this is a long time, 3 hours. You're tired. I can see your faces are going like, get me out of here, please, God. I think what we're going to do is start to, this is what we're going to talk about this semester. And I do apologize. I know that you're interested in all the modules, and I could only create, it's just reality, I could only create X amount for the first year. It's because I'm not going on future, so I can't create all of them. But what I'd like you all to do for next time is two things. So if you could please do this. I want you to, so Ted told you, and it wasn't quite right, I want you to find a controversy. He told you the cost, $3.5 billion in Canada for stroke annually, is the cost. I want you to find another figure, a more recent one, by Mike Sharma. Okay, it's Dr. Mike Sharma. And I want you to look up, so two things. Give me a cost estimate of what stroke costs in Canada. And I want you to look up where we put our money in terms of stroke care, what we call stroke care. So if you had $100, I'll make it concrete. If I had $100 for a patient with stroke, how much did I give for what? How much did I give for the MRI they got? How much did I give for the living expenses to be in a bed? And it doesn't have to be exact. And I want you to bring that back to me next week, and we're going to chat about that as we go into the next lecture. Okay, so that's your assignment. And you can send it to me by email, but I don't care. But if you don't, you know, if you have a question or you're saying, I'm finding these conflicting things, I'd like to talk about that. And we're going to talk about, okay, how you estimate costs. And are you all okay with coming to an in-person lecture, or is it causing you great stress? Okay, we're going to tape next time. So if you can't come next time, it'll be taped. But I would love to have you here. I mean, selfishly, I'd rather not talk to the wall. Not very stimulating. And I think we could have much more fun and adapt better. So if you can make it, that's great. If not, we will be taping as of next. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, okay, I got your email from Maria. I know you're at your table. No, we understand. I guess what we were trying to figure out is for the modules, which are fine, is there any way of including the gate one? Because as PTs, the gate is really important for us when it comes
well,
to stroke.
Well, it's not that I didn't include the gate one. Your whole term of the Jewish Riyadh for the on-site building is gates.
It's more gates?
It's more gates.
Okay. It's just that we didn't understand.
It's about, you're going to see the balance slab, you're going to see the gate analysis, and it's all, that's what that one is. So it's not
okay.
That we didn't include the gate. It's
okay.
It's not more like theory and practice on-site. Yes.
Okay. Okay, yeah, because I think that was something that was important for us to, as one of the important modules that
we
took.
Well, the other thing is I can adapt, you know, like, I can adapt, so I can do a full
okay.
But it's just that I had asked them to do it, so.
Okay, if they're going to do it, then that's fine. We thought there was a method to that. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good. So I don't have to address your email.
No, you don't. No, thank you.
Well, what do you want to do? And you want to film yourself?
Well, every guest left.
Okay, but you need a video of you talking? Well, because there's already a lecture recording system. Like your voice.
Okay, and I'm almost ready there.
Okay. It's much easier. You can have
because they told me to ask
for
the microphone.
Right. You
like
no, you need to use the room microphone.
Once.
to have, this is from last week, okay, to have the microphone and camera plugged in before you start that. Otherwise,
yeah,
you have problems. So now we make, again, we need a guest, presenter.
There it is.
Okay, now you'll be able to start webcam.